Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to be talking with Fred Redman, International Vice President with the United Steelworkers, about jobs and mobilizing people, getting folks out in the streets, and start pushing for an agenda that says, you know what, we working people, we matter. The sad reality in this country, if you work with your hands, if you work with the ache of your back and the sweat of your brow, there are no champions left for you in the political realm. You're going to have to do the heavy lifting yourself and with the help of people like Fred and the steelworkers. So it'll be interesting to talk to him. Also here in the first hour, Vincent Alvarez, president of the New York City Central Labor Council, going to be here talking about their March for Jobs and Economic Fairness on Thursday, December 1st in New York City. And really, you know, it's what I've been calling for several years now. The more people we get out in the streets, the more people are visible, the more you're seen, the more the anger is seen, the more it makes those at the top a little uneasy. If you're sitting in the ivory tower, you got to be worrying, got to be looking over your shoulder, worrying a little bit about this mass mobilization and what it's going to mean for your wealth and what it's going to mean, you know, for doing business in this country, which, again, you know, maybe you see a little loosening of the iron fist. In the second hour, Michelle McIntyre is going to be here. She's the director of the National Consumer League Special Project on Wage Theft. And, you know, here in the holiday season, there are a lot of part-time jobs. A lot of things get overlooked. You know, a little overtime that you got cheated out of. Well, you're only a part-time temporary employee. You don't want to make waves. But, you know, she's going to be here to talk about how you deal with that and maybe how you avoid getting into the situation altogether. Also in the second hour, Andrew Yale, who is a grad student at the University of Chicago. He's also a writing instructor there. He's going to be here talking about his work as an organizer with the Graduate Students United. Look, these are workers. This kid does basically the job of the professor, yet not paid for it. And what's sadly going on across the country is you're seeing a lot of these teaching assistants teaching the low-level courses and not making anything, really. And you're seeing, you know, the schools charging full tuition rates. I'm of the mindset, you know what? We should be paying the person who's standing up there teaching the course, and we should have the best people possible. But it'll be interesting to talk to him. And your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Hope everyone had a happy Thanksgiving. Hope everyone got their fill of the turkey and all the things that go along with it, as well as family and friends, and hopefully it was that kind of an occasion. And I got to be honest, I'm kind of looking at this Thanksgiving as probably the last. Yeah, you always thought Thursday was going to be the day that, you know, you had to spend with family, and you know, I was talking to, you know, some older folks who said, you know, Friday was kind of that day too. Black Friday was kind of a shopping day, but it was more of, hey, I got a day home with my family. You went out and you did your shopping. It was a family type day. This has turned into something that's just nuts. And I got a press release today. Anyway, I want to thank the Tea Party people. Thank you, Tea Partiers. You have saved the economy. I'm not kidding. The Independence Hall Tea Party people have started this group, Liberate Philadelphia, Liberate America. They have said that thanks to their efforts, retail sales were up by 6.6% over last year because they called for a boycott. See, the folks at the occupation people, those people, they called for a boycott because, you know, they're upset about consumerism. They're upset about all this cheap crap coming in from China and everywhere else. You know, they're trying to point out the fact that, you know, that's part of what causes the inequity here in the country. Well, the Tea Party people, they put their foot down and they had a boycott. And that call by these folks at the Tea Party group made people rush out to the stores. It's remarkable. No one could have ever imagined that people would have gone shopping on Black Friday. No one could have ever imagined that. But these people, and they're taking credit for it in their press release, that it was because, you know, the American people, thanks to our call, it resonated with them. And they went out and they shopped. Now, the person who's the head of it said, of course, we got a little help from the retailers. A little help. However, Occupy's Black Friday boycott message was carried in thousands of newspapers in the run-up. It's clear that Americans rejected the idea. So basically, I mean, it's kind of like, I guess it would kind of be like taking credit for the buffet being gone at a sumo wrestling contest. If you had a sumo wrestling tournament and all the food was gone from the buffet, and you could take credit for that. Somehow I made that happen. No, the sumo wrestlers did. But they're going to take credit for it. So I'm going to give them credit for it. Congratulations to the Tea Party people for convincing Americans to buy things. Boy, wow, that's power. Pure power. Good for you. I don't know if you saw it. In fact, I'm going to give Tea Party people the credit for the woman in Los Angeles. I don't know if you saw the story, and I'm sure most people have by now, that a woman went into a Walmart, had, I guess, a game plan. You know, went in with her pepper spray, decided she was going to, you know, blast through the aisle with some pepper spray, make sure that she got her Xbox or whatever it is she was looking for. About 20 people were injured. There, you know, some chaos. Other people still shopped. I didn't get hit by it. I'm going to keep going. Well, she has turned herself in, evidently. And they released her. They're not sure if there's going to be charges. They're kind of looking at it. I'm predicting a couple of lawsuits. So there you go. But you know, the Black Friday, it broke records. Like I said, 6.5% over last year. Black Friday alone, $11.4 billion in sales, according to the people at ShopperTrack. You know, and they said that's a huge increase. Foot traffic in stores, they said, was up 5.1%, which is pretty good, because we need that. Need to get people back to work and need, you know, things generated. The National Retail Federation reported that sales for the weekend were up $52.4 billion. That means the average shopper in their calculations spent almost $400, up from about $365 last year. So congratulations. We got a big push into the holiday season, and we need to consume more. And we need more Black Friday and Small Business Saturday and Cyber Monday. I prescribe to the I Surrender Sunday. Because, you know, like sheep, we've bought into this. We fall for it every year. You know, they throw out these carrots and they entice us into the stores. And what I've always asked is, you know, if you're able to sell a TV for $400 that you usually sell for $1,200, why can't you just sell the thing for $600 all the time? But we get into this, you know, and I guess we don't ask for these so-called deals year round. I mean, Walmart, they claim to have these lowest prices. But yet magically at Christmas time on Black Friday, somehow they get lower because it's a magical day. And I'm going, are we really that big of suckers? And the answer is yes. I mean, you know, they throw a little carrot out there and we dangle around because we believe, you know, there's competition. No competition? Has anyone heard of collusion? I would go along with collusion more than I would go along with competition. But here's the thing, and the reason I say this is probably going to be the last Thanksgiving. You could mark the calendar, mark my word. There will not be a store in this country that is not open at least 9 o'clock Thursday night. And I'm saying they're going to be open all day Thursday. So all day Thanksgiving, you're going to see stores open. It's going to be just another shopping day, another day of the year. And it's just going to be getting earlier and earlier. And then you know what's going to happen? We're going to have Wacky Wednesday to go along with Turkey Thursday, into Black Friday and Small Business Sunday and Cyber Monday. For me, it kind of ruins the whole idea of the holiday, which is about being with family, which is about, you know, for people who are Christians, you know, buying into that whole birth thing. Not about how much we can consume. Heaven knows our economy needs it, so good. You want to go out and spend? Go spend, spend, spend. But understand that what you're spending on made elsewhere. So this stimulus, this great day, these billions that we've poured into buying these priceless treasures that we're going to give to our children and our parents and our brothers and sisters and all of that, who's it helping? I didn't go out on Black Friday. Sorry, didn't do it. Didn't go out on Insane Saturday. Didn't go out on Stupendous Sunday. In fact, I didn't buy anything here on Cyber Monday. But I will do my shopping, and when I go, I will be looking for American-made products. I will be looking for union-made products. I will be looking for things that are going to keep my neighbors and the people in my state and in my country employed, because it's good for the nation. You want to talk about the stimulus? Let's get people back to work by using this consumer holiday. Because I guess at this point, we might as well give up on the whole meaning of the holiday and just, it is what it is. It's that time of year when we overconsume everything and it helps our economy. Maybe that's what we need. But I think we should be stimulating our own economy. And it shouldn't be just how much can the big box retailers take in and how much can the executives stuff into their pockets. But how do we keep each other going? You know, I was listening to my kids this weekend. We took a couple of day trips, and my 5-year-old is learning the Pledge of Allegiance, and he has taught it to my 3-year-old, who and just loves the under God part. Is thrilled with that. She loves the punchline for her. She loves that. But indivisible. That word stuck with me this weekend. Indivisible. With liberty and justice for all, just kind of stuck with me, thinking, you know, we should be one nation, thinking about each other, taking care of each other. And if that means, you know what, this holiday season, when I go to look at the trinkets and the tokens and the things that I buy to show people what I think of them, or, you know, to kind of impress upon them that they mean something to me because I thought enough to go buy them something, I will think enough to buy it from somewhere, from people who made it here. Just my thought. Anyway, going to take a quick break. When we come back, Fred Redmond, International Vice President with the United Steelworkers Union, right back after this. You are listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Tonight we turn back the clock to what we were talking about this time last year. We'll be back live and in the studio on Monday. Enjoy your Thanksgiving holiday.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
Occupy Wall Street has taken on a major relief effort called Occupy Sandy in the wake of the superstorm that hit the East Coast October 28th. WIN's Melinda Tuhus visited a low-income high-rise in Far Rockaway in the borough of Queens on a thin strip of land between Jamaica Bay and the Atlantic Ocean.
Sabrina Jackson lives in Ocean Village, a complex with 11 buildings and several hundred residents. Heat and power are slowly returning, though by midweek she still had neither and was told it may be Thanksgiving before she does.
Yeah, Thanksgiving. Are you serious? We're supposed to have family, friends over to your apartment, to your homes, with lights, warmth. That's love. This right here is sad. It's depressing.
Jackson says the Red Cross has been by once or twice with hot food and blankets. FEMA has distributed applications for reimbursement for losses suffered in the storm, and the National Guard knocked on every door to check on residents. But Occupy Sandy has an ongoing presence, coordinating with local residents to distribute emergency supplies. Jackson is the coordinator for her complex. Volunteers move around a large room divided into sections for non-perishable food, clothing, disposable diapers, toiletry items, batteries, and more, filling requests from residents for specific items. Jackson keeps an eye out for residents making too frequent requests for things, which they are likely to sell. Outside St. Jacoby's Lutheran Church in Brooklyn, site coordinator Pablo Benson Silva explains how the operation works.
Our job here is to make sure we match drivers with volunteers and supplies and take it out to different sites that we've opened and the most affected areas. Right now that we're talking about Far Rockaway, Coney Island, Staten Island, Sheepheads Bay.
One of the first volunteers to arrive Monday morning is Dan Lohouse, who lives in Brooklyn and whose day job is working with the underserved. He's on his own time now, though, explaining he got involved about a week ago.
I spent a good week just watching it on TV and then finally got up off the couch and couldn't live with myself anymore. And then ever since I've started, I can't stop now. Now I'm just kind of hooked.
As he moves around the church basement gathering supplies, he says he's headed to Staten Island for the next phase of work.
I'm trying to load up on work gloves, contractor bags, bleach and cleaning supplies, flashlights and batteries. Those seem to be the hot ticket items. I'm also really trying to find crowbars, hammers, stuff to take out the drywall and all the wet stuff.
Melinda Tuhus, Workers Independent News, Brooklyn and Far Rockaway, New York City.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Your working class radio experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Work it hard to make a left, rich and from the red. Father Sir, left the cameo, blue devil, head as bait. Oh, he's a working class man.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickssmithshow.com. So some big numbers coming out of Wisconsin. The folks at United Wisconsin have said that they have collected over 300,000 signatures to recall Governor Scott Walker in just the first 12 days. They say that works out to over 1,000 signatures an hour. Now, remember, they've got to get somewhere, I guess it was around 550,000. They are more than halfway there in just 12 days. And you gotta love, the Wisconsin Republican Party's response to this massive event. They said this recall effort is a baseless power grab being pushed on Wisconsin families by liberal special interests. Gotta expect that. Despite the Democrats' attempt to generate false momentum in their never-ending effort to score political points, Wisconsin families are only interested in moving our state forward. They continue by saying, we remain focused on Governor Walker's common sense reforms that have laid the groundwork for economic growth, and our economy only continues to improve, they say. So 300,000 plus signatures equals false momentum. And 43rd in the nation in economic recovery, somehow that's economic growth. I seem to think there was a guy who wrote a book, 1984. War is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength. Kind of ring a bell? He was right. Anyway, I've got Fred Redmond on the phone. He's an international vice president with the United Steelworkers Union. Fred, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, thanks, Rick. It's always good to be with you.
You know, I look at this, 300,000 signatures in just the first 12 days. I think that's remarkable.
Yeah, I think so, too. I was listening to your update, and that's a clear indication that the American people is convinced that we're going to take our country back. That's fantastic.
So false momentum, do you think? False momentum? I mean, that's kind of it's laughable.
Yeah, it is. It is laughable. Look, Scott Walker, he came after the people in Wisconsin very viciously. He not only came after union workers, organized labor, he came after students, he came after senior citizens. So I think what we are witnessing with the number of signatures that's being signed for the recall effort is that the people of Wisconsin have said that they bought a bill of goods. They invested in a guy who don't represent their interests, and it all gives a
And that's the key to all of this. I mean, what happened in Wisconsin back in February, I think has spurred across the nation a thirsting of average, everyday working class people to gather together and say, you know what, we're going in the wrong direction. The economy is not working for Joe Sixpack and Joe Lunchbox. How do we turn that around? How do we harness this power of people finally taking to the streets over the money that poured into the Tea Party people?
Well, yeah, I mean, you're exactly right, Rick. I think what we're seeing is the reaction to bad public policies that's intended to enhance the wealthy and the privileged in this country by oppressing those in the middle class and the working class and the poor. So I think what we're seeing in Wisconsin, I think that Wisconsin is just a microcosm of the anxiety that's being felt by people around this country, because they don't see their state and their federal government working on their best interests. So, this is a good sign that the American people, is ready to stand up and say enough is enough.
I mean, you look at this, 300,000 in just 12 days. You look at the fact that in Ohio, they push back on SB5 and not just push back on it, overwhelmingly threw it back at Governor Kasich. So we're seeing around the country a lot of this right-wing, wet dream policy going down in flames.
Yeah, and I think that, this is not a fight that's being waged by a certain group of people that's fighting back and pushing back. I think that this extreme right-wing agenda have affected the lifestyles of every element of society except the rich and the privileged. So I think what we are witnessing in America is a coming together of workers, whether they're unionized workers or non-union workers, students and senior citizens who's concerned about issues such as Medicaid and Social Security, students worried about their tuitions, workers worried about going back to work, workers worried about being able to join a union and have a say-so in wages, hours, and working conditions. And, the American people have finally said enough is enough. The government is not working for them, and they're speaking out loud and clear. In Wisconsin, it's just a microcosm of what I think 2012 is going to have in store for us.
Now, you're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Fred Bredman. He's an International Vice President of Human Affairs with the United Steelworkers Union. In your travels, in your work as an International Vice President there with the Steelworkers Union, I'm sure you come across a lot of this organization going on, because the steelworkers are really on the cutting edge of progressive politic, if you will, but also in mobilizing and organizing people. Are you seeing more of an interest in not only your members, but also the general public in coming together? Because I have been seeing a lot more people saying, you know what, peeking their head up, off the treadmill and going, hey, what's going on?
Yeah, we're seeing that all over the country. We're seeing a reaction by people, and as you stated, not just our members, but as, we're seeing a reaction of people who's been affected by the policies. They're just not working for them, Rick. It's just, the government is not representing working class people, poor people, the disenfranchised. And what we are witnessing is even some people who went to the polls in November and decided to, turn the government over, I think we're seeing people having second thoughts,
right,
saying this is not what we voted for.
Yeah, they voted for jobs in November of 2010, and yet you've got a party, Republican Party, who they had their little slogan pledge. They had their color brochure, 48 pages, 27 pages of pictures, 21 pages of flowery words. But basically they said, we're about jobs, jobs, jobs. And I remember John Boehner said, laser focus.
That's right.
Kind of lost that laser.
And they put forth not one policy to create jobs to stimulate the economy. So, look, I think that the American people are smart. The American people are feeling the pain of an economy that's not working for them. And, it's about time that people stood up and said, hey, look, enough is enough. We cannot shoulder the burden of the irresponsibilities of banks and Wall Street on our shoulders. It's that we have to have shared sacrifice. And I think that this is a response to those in the political system who are there just to protect the rich and the privileged in this country. So, you know, this is a good development that's taking place in Wisconsin, but we have to keep it up until we take our states and take our country back and put America back into the country that it was designed to be, where everybody, you know, have an opportunity to work hard, to pay their taxes, to play by the rules, and to live a middle-class lifestyle, which is to be able to take care of their families, to work, to see to it that their children have a better opportunity than they have. And that's the American dream, Rick.
Absolutely.
And that's what the fight is for.
Well, I mean, one of the first things I set up when President Obama took office, and I've said this numerous times, because the very first words that came out of my mouth after his inauguration was, I hope he's the guy who saves work in this country by making sure that it's rewarding, that people can actually pay their bills and send their kids to college and do the things that the American dream allows us to do because we work hard and we should be compensated for it.
Well, that's exactly right. And I think that we as people became somewhat complacent. I remember standing out on the mall when the president was inaugurated, and this president made it clear. He said every morning he needs to wake up and feel the winds of change at his back. And I think a lot of American people went to sleep. We got complacent.
Yep.
And we saw attacks being leveled at this president that was unprecedented. You know, then despite the attacks, this president has passed some policies that's good, such as the Lilly Ledbetter Act. You know, despite the rhetoric, you know, he has cut taxes for the middle class, and he's done everything he can to stimulate the economy. But the resistance that's being leveled against this president and his policies is unprecedented.
Yeah, I mean, so, when you've got businesses saying we're not going to hire people until he's out of office, and you've got
people, right.
You've got corporate America sitting on trillions of dollars of cash and buying back shares so they can increase their profit, their salaries, you got a real problem in this nation.
Yeah, we got a real problem, and you know, we have never seen an economy like this since the Great Depression. And,
are you
and look, this is people who is occupying the Congress and the Senate in Washington D.C. who is only concerned about one job, and that is President Obama.
Right.
And they have turned their back on working people and the poor in this country.
And, of course, their own and feeding their own pockets. Are you encouraged by the Occupy Wall Street people? Because, I mean, most of the message that I'm hearing, if you get past the rhetoric that the right keeps throwing out, that they're vagrants and that they don't know why they're there, but if you get past and you listen to what they're saying, it's stuff that I think labor has been saying for 30 years.
Well, they're morally grounded. I and you're exactly right. I mean, the issues that they have raised in Occupy movement, you know, issues of inequality and you know, issues of fairness and you know, issues of, you know, paying attention to the least of those in this society and you know, raising issues of just total unfairness, excuse me, is issues that we've been fighting for over 20 years. So we're very encouraged by the Occupy movement. It's sad to see the resistance that's taking place, especially I was watching the television this evening, seeing the reports coming out of Oakland.
Right.
And, you know, it's just disturbing to see the resistance among some cities against peaceful protesters. And we sat back last year and, you know, watched people in the Tea Party movement going to public rallies, carrying weapons, and the hatred that came out of that movement. And to watch people who are standing up for basic fairness being, you know, resisted and humiliated by some politicians in this country is very disturbing. But the good news is the Occupy movement seemed to have some staying power. There's a momentum out there that people are sick and tired of just being sick and tired, and they want their government to work with them. So we stand with the Occupy movement, and, you know, we support their efforts, and organized labor is with them all the way.
It's good to hear. Last question I've got for you. I'm viewing the battlefield in front of me, and it looks like the next battleground is going to be Indiana. Indiana's talking about a right-to-work piece of legislation, which, again, is neither a right-to-work or any right, or it has anything to do with work. It's just a right-to-work for less. Do you see that kind of in the same vein that I do? Because I think that's the next battlefront.
I think it is, too. Last week, there was a huge demonstration at the state capitol. Our union had over 500 steel workers that joined other international unions at the state capitol to make sure that their voices are heard. This is an issue in Indiana that we're going to stay on top of. The whole labor movement have rallied together, and we're going to see to it that this right-to-work legislation is defeated. And let me just say this, Rick. They tried to pass this legislation in Indiana before, and the government was literally shut down by brave legislators who, you know, took the necessary steps to avoid having to vote on such a draconian bill. But there's a good Democratic caucus, even though they're in the minority in Indiana. These are some people who are committed to their constituents, to the working class. And we're going to stand together with them, those of us in labor, to do everything that we can to defeat right to work in Indiana.
Because the reason I ask you is because, you know, I see that there are four bills here in the Pennsylvania legislature put forth by Mad Cow out in the western side of the state of Pennsylvania. You know, this is an argument, this is a discussion, this is an educational opportunity, all those things wrapped up into one ball of why are these right-wingers going after this kind of legislation when you see the numbers across the board shows that working people do worse in these so-called right-to-work states.
Well, not only do working people do worse, there's no credible evidence that states prosper. You know, when they eliminate people's right to collectively bargain on issues of wages, hours, and working conditions, there's no evidence. When we look at some of the poorest states in the country, when you just take a look at the South and states like Mississippi and Georgia and Alabama, and you look at the unemployment rates in those states and the amount of people that's living in poverty, that there's no credible evidence to show that right-to-work laws in no way stimulate employment. So, you know, this is a attempt that, you know, merely designed to break unions. And, you know, we're going to push back. And, you know, Indiana is the one we're going to pay attention to. But we're also keeping our eyes on Pennsylvania.
All right. Fred Redmond, I appreciate the time, International Vice President with the United Steelworkers Union. I would love to have you back again soon as these things pop up. We'd love to have you back.
Thanks, Rick. Anytime. I appreciate the work you do and appreciate the listeners and appreciate everything that you do, Rick, on behalf of working families.
Thanks so much, Fred. Going to take a quick break. Back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask me, Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
If for no other reason, President Obama's re-election was a victory in the sense that America averted a hard Romney-Ryan lurch rightward, downward, and backward all at once. Ouch, that would have hurt. By campaign's end, it was painfully clear that Romney, a lifelong son of privilege, had no understanding of, empathy with, or appreciation for ordinary workaday Americans. He really is a born CEO who accepts in his heart, mind, and soul the Ayn Randian fiction that America really is made up of a small class of noble producers and a mass of moochers. The man from Bain Capital, who had made a fortune by taking over corporations and coldly axing longtime loyal employees, quietly brought that corporate side of his character back into play on election night. Even as he was on national television delivering his brief concession speech, his campaign apparatus was being swiftly dismantled. Left in the lurch were Romney's many staffers who had toiled so faithfully for so long. Late that night, many of these disappointed and weary ones grabbed cabs home from the campaign's headquarters, only to find upon arrival that the Romney for President credit cards they had been using were suddenly no good. Without even telling these aides, the boss who wanted to be our nation's leader had abruptly yanked this modest benefit from the people who had tried to help him get there. They had just lost their jobs, but multimillionaire Mitt stuck them with paying out-of-pocket for cab fare. This is Jim Hightower saying, come on, with untold millions stashed in offshore bank accounts, couldn't Romney have ponied up a few small bills to cover this last ride home? Of course he could have, but he wouldn't. Of all things to think of doing on election night, cutting off his employees' credit cards was a priority. We're lucky this sorry character lost.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Tonight we turn back the clock to what we were talking about this time last year. We'll be back live and in the studio on Monday. Enjoy your Thanksgiving holiday.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
What they do, they smile in your face. All the time they want to take your place. The backstabbers, backstabbers.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of our program, you can download our podcast there at the website or download the Stitcher app if you have a smartphone and take your class war on the go. I've been doing an awful lot of reading about Teddy Roosevelt. And, you know, I'm looking for that. I don't care, Democrat, Republican, Teddy Roosevelt happened to be a Republican. I'm looking for that next politician, that next leader, that person that's going to step up and say, this is reality. And he was that guy of that time. He was the big trust buster. He was the guy, walks softly, carry a big stick, kind of mentality. And I was reading his annual message to Congress dated December 3rd, 1901. And it just jumped off the page at me. And it's one of these things I have to share. Stick with me through this reading because I just think it grabbed me, and I'm hoping it grabs you. He writes, it is no limitation upon property rights or freedom of contract to require that when men receive from government the privilege of doing business under corporate form, which frees them from individual responsibilities, and enables them to call into their enterprises the capital of the public, they shall do so upon absolutely truthful representations as to the value of the property in which the capital is to be invested. Corporations engaged in interstate commerce should be regulated if they are found to exercise a license working to the public injury. It should be as much the aim of those who seek for social betterment to rid the business world of crimes of cunning as to rid the entire body politic of crimes of violence. The great corporations exist only because they are created and safeguarded by our institutions, and it is therefore our right and our duty to see that they work in harmony with these institutions. You know, and it just, you think back, 1901, that's 110 years ago. You go back and you stop and you think about this. We're dealing with the same problems over and over and over. We're learning the same lessons again and again and again. Back then, corporations held all the power. They held all the cards. You had two classes of people, and this is where the investor class of this country wants us to go. This is where the wealth class wants us, a two-class society. those who have, and of course those who do not. And they keep saying, well, you know, we don't need regulation. We can police ourselves. Corporations are people. No, they're not. And like Roosevelt says, look, they have a privilege in this country of doing business under the corporate form. It's a privilege. Yet what they've done a masterful job of messaging of doing is telling us that we need to be more business friendly. We need to surrender more of our freedoms. We need to surrender more of our land and our health and our labor so that they may prosper. And I'm sorry, I'm just not going there with you. And I look at this guy down in Georgia. Some businessman, Bill Loomis is his name, or Lumen, owns U.S. Cranes in Waco, Georgia. He decided to put on the side of his vehicles, you know, his trucks, we are not hiring until Obama is gone. Now he claims that he's got business to hire new people. He wants to hire new people, but he believes so strongly in the country that he's going to hold off on hiring until Obama's out of office. And I'm thinking about this, and I'm going, you know, you look at the tax credits Obama's given to businesses so that they maybe hire new workers. There's the $4,000 tax credit, to hire people who are long-term unemployed. There's another one that they just signed to hire veterans. So there's a lot of money out there for an entrepreneur who has the ability to hire people. And it's these kind of folks, that are scary. And I don't know the guy. But I do get this bizarre feeling that it really has nothing to do with his policies. It has nothing to do with Obama's policies. It had a lot to do with that black guy being in the White House. Because if you look at his Facebook page, all these Obama conspiracy theories out there, all of this really pretty bizarre stuff, all of this really radical teabag, angry stuff, a lot of pro-Confederate stuff, a lot of anti-Muslim stuff, kind of makes you wonder, doesn't it? And it's just, you go, oh, it's just one guy. But when you have a nation where the engine, be it on Wall Street or in Georgia, is get that black guy out of the White House, and we're going to hold the nation hostage until you do, regardless of business. I mean, this guy's no business. This guy's no capitalist. This guy's no business owner. And if he is, he's not a very smart one, because he's got the ability to hire workers, put them on, and make a profit from their labor, which I got to wonder about. You got to question his motive in not doing it. No businessman that I know is going to not hire people and not make profit. Kind of makes you wonder. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, in New York on Thursday, they're going to have a big march for jobs and for economic fairness. When we come back, we're going to talk with Vincent Alvarez, the president of the New York Central Labor Council, about the march and, you know, what they're doing out there and why. Right back after this.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by Ask Me Council 13.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of the Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
Earth, sky.
In November 2012, two scientists at the National Center for Atmospheric Research released an analysis of 16 major climate models.
Their goal was to see which models best matched the reality of our existing climate, in order to assess which model's temperature projections might best match our future climate.
The conclusion? Climate models that projected a greater rise in global temperature are likely to prove more accurate than those showing a lesser rise. These scientists, John Fasulo and Kevin Trenberth, published their results in the journal Science.
When asked if these results suggest a profound change in the world our children and grandchildren will live in, Dr. Fasulo told EarthSky he believes they do. He said the results suggest that even the world we live in the coming decades, is likely to differ considerably from the one we grew up in.
Dr. Trenberth, on the other hand, was more cautious in his reply. He said the results tentatively favor future global temperatures on the higher end of the scale.
No global climate model can predict the future. A higher temperature rise in the years ahead would produce greater impacts on society in terms of sea level rise, heat waves, droughts, and other extremes. Will that happen? It's likely many of you hearing this broadcast will live long enough to see and judge for yourself. For more, come to EarthSky.org and search for the words climate model. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Tonight we turn back the clock to what we were talking about this time last year. We'll be back live and in the studio on Monday. Enjoy your Thanksgiving holiday.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can also email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all email personally. I listen to that labor history minute there for a second. And I thought back to Gingrich saying, you know, those child labor laws, those are just dumb. And again, you know, as I've been saying, you know, we read the Teddy Roosevelt quote from in the last segment. They're taking us back to that era. They want us back in the 90s, the good old days of the 90s. The 1890s, which is why I'm glad people are out in the street and we're seeing more and more folks. I'd love to see all 14 million unemployed people get to the street. But in New York City on Thursday, December 1st, 4 o'clock, Herald Square, there is going to be a March for Jobs and Economic Fairness. And I've got Vincent Alvarez, president of the New York City Central Labor Council, on the line to talk a little bit about it. Vincent, thanks for taking time for me.
How are you, Rick? It's great to be on the line with you tonight. Want to thank you for having me on.
I appreciate you taking time for us. You know, we met in Ohio with the last really big victory there over SB 5 when they turned back issue number 2 there in Ohio. And I'm hoping, you know, Wisconsin, over 300,000 signatures in just 12 days. You're seeing this
terrific
swelling of people from just average working people saying enough is enough already.
Well, you know, you and I both saw it. We saw it up close and personal in Ohio, and the message that I had to the folks, not only who were, we had such a tremendous amount of diversity in folks from around the region, from different sectors, from throughout the country, and the folks who didn't have a chance for one reason or other to get out there, I said to them there was such unity and so much strength that was shown out there, and everybody, all working people, both unionized and non-unionized workers, I think they got it out there, and that's why there was such a resounding and overwhelming victory for working people in Ohio. And we're looking to take that unity to the streets in New York City this Thursday, December 1st, and we look to have a very large march for something we've been talking about for many years now, jobs and economic fairness. We know fundamentally this is a jobs crisis in the country today, and we're going to get out there on the streets with not only with folks from labor, but with student groups, retirees, community groups, veterans groups, and anybody who's really just concerned about what's going on here in America for working people. And we look forward to having a big day on Thursday.
Yeah, I saw a guy interviewed on C-SPAN over the weekend, and he said, you know, if you're somebody who works with your hands for a living, if you make your living with your hands in this country, you have really no champions left. And where I would correct that is I'm hoping that, you know, this swell of people in the streets begins that process of of labor moving to the forefront and being that champion.
Well, you know, Rick, we got each other. Working people have each other, and we've got each other's backs, and that's what we need to keep realizing, whether it's Ohio, whether it's both Wisconsin, or whether it's, you know, New York City this week. We got each other's backs. An attack on one of us is, as we always say, is attack on all of us. So we're going to be out there in the streets. We're going to be talking about the growing economic disparity that we see in this country. You know, I read an article the other morning, and it's the last thing you want to wake up to, but when you hear that 1 in 3 Americans here in America, nearly 100 million Americans are living in or close to poverty, it makes you stop and just shake your head and say, what's going on?
And we're supposed to be the wealthiest nation, not only in the world, but in the history of the world.
That's correct. And we have the, you know, all the numbers we know about, the sky-high unemployment, the long-term unemployment, the growing number of Americans, as I said, living in poverty, the concentration of wealth. All of these things, I think, resonate with everyday working Americans. They get it. They're working hard. They're doing everything they can to play by the rules, and they're saying to themselves, something isn't right. And you know what? They're right. Something has gone wrong in America, and we need to get together, and we have to say enough is enough, and whether it be corporate CEOs or, frankly speaking, whether it be government in general, we need to say that we are seeking solutions and not excuses. We need to turn this around, and we need to turn it around for everyday working Americans.
So, you know, beyond that, you know, beyond just saying that, how do you get to that point? You know, the question then becomes, how do you make sure that we have some economic justice, that we have some fairness? And the right loves to paint it as, well, they want everybody to be equal. I mean, you're not pushing the idea that everyone needs to be absolutely equal and we're going to divide everything up, that everybody gets the exact slice of the pie. That's not what we're talking about.
Absolutely not. And what we are saying, though, is that, listen, the cold, hard facts suggest that there have been some throughout this real difficult time that we've seen here over the past 5 years in America, but even over the past few decades here in America, there have been some that have been extraordinarily immune to seeing some of the negative and really feeling some of the negative downturn and the negative effects in our economy, while there have been others who have just not only coasted but have done extraordinarily well. And what we are seeking, really, is an element of fairness. We're seeking a fair, proportionate, and really, Rick, the irony here is a traditional approach to these problems in America. Because this is a relatively new philosophy that some have in America. Because for years, everybody has contributed in a fair and proportionate way to solving some of the problems and to seeking solutions. But that's all turned over the past, you know, several years now. And what we've seen as a result of it, to me, it's a logical culmination of just economic policies which have worked to benefit very few at the expense of very many here in America. So we got to really begin to keep focusing on those issues, focusing on the problems, and demanding, not asking, but demanding that government and corporate America participate in finding solutions to some of these problems that are really just striking at the heart of American families.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Vincent Alvarez, president of the New York City Central Labor Council, NYCCLC.org, the website. We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on Vincent Alvarez's name. It'll take you right there. You know, as we're talking about this, and, you know, one of the things that I've always said is, you know, I don't know that we need more government policy. I think what we need is direct action. We need people in their job site, in their communities, coming out, sticking together and fighting back. And for me, all of this inequality could be solved by you guys in organized labor getting out there and more people organizing and demanding more of the wealth that they produce.
Well, you know, what we are what we've seen when we decided about 3 weeks ago, you know, our executive board met, we spoke about it, we decided to have this march this week for jobs and economic fairness, and it was overwhelming, really, the response. It was the response not only from folks from within labor, as I said, but student groups and other community-based groups, faith-based groups. And what we've seen is people from outside of New York City as well say, hey, you know what, we want to come into the city because we want to continue to highlight and point out the need to find these solutions to these problems. And I think the irony, Rick, is when you stand back and you look at the problem, fundamentally we have a jobs crisis in this country, but it's a form of an economic problem. And the problem here is there is a solution to it. But the solution, if we're ever going to get to it, means empowering everyday working Americans. And that is a threat to a lot of folks out there.
Yep.
A lot of folks who are on the upper strata of the income strata in America. So we need to make sure that, you know, we just say, listen, all we want is a level of fairness, and we want you to participate in the solutions to those problems. And I think if we continue to get together and make sure that we have a unified front, I think that they'll come along. I really do. I'm optimistic about it, and I'm looking forward to continuing it this week in New York City.
Yeah, I mean, you got to think for their own self-interest, because if you've got a prosperous middle class, got a class of people who have disposable income, there's demand there that entrepreneurs can service, and there's profit to be made there.
Well, you hit the nail on the head, because that's what it comes down to. It's fundamentally a problem that people don't – the reason why we're not having the levels of growth, the reason why we're not having a sustained and broad-based recovery in this country is because working people don't no longer have – the level of income to sustain that. And so that's what we have to get back to doing. You know, I mean, so much of the income is now going towards just keeping their heads above water, whether it be the high cost of student loans for younger students and for families, whether it be housing, whether it be the fact that so many of them have to fund their own retirement, whether so many of them have to fund their own health care plans, or at least a substantial portion of it. All these things lead to an economy where you're never going to have the levels of demand that were needed to have a broad-based recovery and sustained, long-term sustained economic growth, which is going to help our economy in the macro sense, in a broad way, throughout the country. So it all begins with empowering workers.
Yeah, and also, not to cut you off there, but the reality is we need smart governmental policy that's going to encourage domestic production. We've got trade policies that are just destroying our nation. And I look at, you know, the Tea Party people in Philadelphia are taking credit for Black Friday being such a huge success because they were going against those Occupy People's boycott with their boycott. You know, whose economy did we stimulate with the big weekend of $54 billion in spending? The Chinese.
Well, it's, you know what, everybody that I talk to, and it's not a Republican problem, it's not a Democratic problem, it's an American issue. And everybody that I speak to, everyday working people that I speak to, they want to continue to be the overwhelmingly supportive and generous country that we are. We live in the greatest nation, I believe, in the world. And at the same token, though, they want to make sure that we have trade policies and economic policies that makes sense.
Yep.
And a lot of them today just don't make sense.
Not at all. And, you know, I look at your website. You've got on there no rally, no speeches. It's all been said before. The March for Jobs and Economic Fairness. Vincent Alvarez, president of the New York City Central Labor Council. I appreciate your time, and I wish you guys nothing but the best. I would love to hear how it turns out.
We would love to have some folks out in Pennsylvania as well. I know you you have a wide area out there which you go to. We'd love to see them in New York City this Thursday.
All right, a great place to go, nyccclc.org, the website, or go to the RickSmithShow.com and click on Vincent Alvarez's name. Vincent, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Rick. Appreciate it.
All right, let's take a quick break. When we come back at the top of the hour, I want to talk a little bit about what's going on with the wage theft. You know, the holiday season's here. A lot of temporary jobs. Yeah, who knows what goes on? A little here or there. We're going to talk to the director of the National Consumer League's special project on wage theft. Back after this. You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Tonight we turn back the clock to what we were talking about this time last year. We'll be back live and in the studio on Monday. Enjoy your Thanksgiving holiday.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
Occupy Wall Street has taken on a major relief effort called Occupy Sandy in the wake of the superstorm that hit the East Coast October 28th. WIN's Melinda Tuhus visited a low-income high-rise in Far Rockaway in the borough of Queens on a thin strip of land between Jamaica Bay and the Atlantic Ocean.
Sabrina Jackson lives in Ocean Village, a complex with 11 buildings and several hundred residents. Heat and power are slowly returning, though by midweek she still had neither and was told it may be Thanksgiving before she does.
Yeah, Thanksgiving. Are you serious? We're supposed to have family, friends over to your apartment, to your homes, with lights, warmth. That's love. This right here is sad. It's depressing.
Jackson says the Red Cross has been by once or twice with hot food and blankets. FEMA has distributed applications for reimbursement for losses suffered in the storm, and the National Guard knocked on every door to check on residents. But Occupy Sandy has an ongoing presence, coordinating with local residents to distribute emergency supplies. Jackson is the coordinator for her complex. Volunteers move around a large room divided into sections for non-perishable food, clothing, disposable diapers, toiletry items, batteries, and more, filling requests from residents for specific items. Jackson keeps an eye out for residents making too frequent requests for things, which they are likely to sell. Outside St. Jacoby's Lutheran Church in Brooklyn, site coordinator Pablo Benson Silva explains how the operation works.
Our job here is to make sure we match drivers with volunteers and supplies and take it out to different sites that we've opened and the most affected areas. Right now that we're talking about Far Rockaway, Coney Island, Staten Island, Sheepheads Bay.
One of the first volunteers to arrive Monday morning is Dan Lowhouse, who lives in Brooklyn and whose day job is working with the underserved. He's on his own time now, though, explaining he got involved about a week ago.
I spent a good week just watching it on TV. And then finally got up off the couch and couldn't live with myself anymore. And then ever since I've started, I can't stop now. Now I'm just kind of hooked.
As he moves around the church basement gathering supplies, he says he's headed to Staten Island for the next phase of work.
I'm trying to load up on work gloves, contractor bags, bleach and cleaning supplies, flashlights and batteries. Those seem to be the hot ticket items. I'm also really trying to find crowbars, hammers, stuff to take out the drywall and all the wet stuff.
Melinda Tuhus, Workers Independent News, Brooklyn and Far Rockaway, New York City.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. I've been doing, a bunch of reading on Teddy Roosevelt, like I said earlier. And I've been reading through this guy, Edmund Morris's book on Roosevelt called Theodore Rex. And, you know, there was something that jumped out at me. He wrote, whenever corporate executives, whatever they might say about increased efficiency and reduced waste, he said the historical inclination of monopoly was always to raise prices and lower wages. And, you know, during this economic downturn, what we're seeing is just that. We're seeing prices going up, and we're seeing this downward pressure, this theft of wages, if you will. How else can you put it? So I got a press release today from the folks over at the National Consumers League. They've got a special project on wage theft, and I said this is a perfect time to be talking about this, which is why I've asked Michelle McIntyre to come talk to us. She's the director of the National Consumer League's special project on wage theft. You can view that at nclnet.org. Or we've got a link at therickSmithShow.com. Michelle, thanks for taking time for me.
Not a problem. Thank you for having me.
You know, you see all these folks working in these big box retail stores. You see all these people doing seasonal labor. And, I never thought, you know, hey, you know, maybe these people are going to get cheated out of something, even though they're only going to be there a short time.
Unfortunately, it happens more and more each year, and especially this year with the recession where it is. A lot of people are just so happy to have work. They don't look into the fine print, pretty much, of what that job description really is.
And you really don't have a feel of how things are going to go until it's probably too late. I would imagine it's going to be short-term, month or two, and by the time you look at your checks, it's breeding ground for trouble, I think.
Absolutely. A lot of people look at it, and they don't even realize that in a lot of cases they're not even technically an employee. They're an independent contractor, which means they have no rights or privileges under the Fair Labor Standards Act. They don't have the right to a minimum wage, to overtime, or even workers' compensation.
Well, doesn't that point to the broken nature of our labor laws?
It definitely does. And thankfully, the Department of Labor has decided to really go after this and enforce it along with the IRS. But in the meantime, a lot of people are misclassified as independent contractors. And then when tax season rolls around, they really get screwed, because the employers have never taken out any of the taxes, so they get screwed by Uncle Sam later on in the year.
And now, is that considered wage theft? I mean, this misclassification, you know, I know some industries, especially, you know, in the small package industry, their business model is based on independent contractors and basically cheating workers out of wages. Do you see much of that?
We are seeing a lot of that, unfortunately. It definitely is a form of wage theft. It is... There are two main forms of wage theft that we're seeing a lot of. One of it is employee misclassification, and the other is unpaid overtime. Happening all across the board right now.
So how much to the argument that, well, you know, you work 60 hours this week, I'll only work you 20 hours next week, this flex time thing, this idea that keeps being popped up every once in a while, what do you think of those lines?
My feeling is as long as at the end of 2 weeks, you're at 80, but preferably at the end of 1 week, if you're making 40, if you have got more than 40 hours, they need to be paying you for that overtime, that time and a half, so you're losing a lot of money that's being left on the table there.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. But, you know, at the end of this, you got folks who, like you said at the beginning, they're struggling to make ends meet, and they're just thankful to get what they can, so they'll get a little bit of abuse.
Absolutely, and that's what we're seeing a lot of people. They're afraid to complain if they have a job right now, for fear that they're going to get retaliated on and get fired. Thankfully, there are laws in place. Unfortunately, the enforcement is just not where it needs to be. It's getting better, much, much better than what it used to be the last couple of years ago. But there's still a lot of work that needs to be done.
So what do you tell someone who, you know, they just found a job, they realize that, hey, I worked 50 hours last week, they paid me straight time for the 50 hours, they paid me 40 and moved 10 or didn't bother paying me at all for those 10 hours. What would someone in that situation do?
The first thing I would say is record and keep all your pay stubs. That's the first line of defense. Thankfully, the Department of Labor has rolled out a free app for the public to use that will help you track how many hours you've worked and also how much you're supposed to be getting in overtime. So it'll do all of the calculations for you. The next thing is compare what you're getting to what you're supposed to be getting from the Department of Labor's calculations. And a lot of times you'll see the discrepancy there. Two, I would suggest that you have the legal name of the employer. A lot of times you think you're working for one company and you're actually working for another. So you need to see who you are responsible to and who you need to be asking those questions of. And then from there, if there are still problems, once you've talked to your supervisor, I would suggest going to a workers' center. So that can be run by a variety of different organizations, including labor unions, and go from there. A lot of them have lawyers on staff who will help you draft a letter sent to them, and a lot of times if they see a letter from a lawyer, they'll start doing what they need to because they're trying to avoid a lawsuit.
Yeah, and then trying to not catch anyone's attention, because a lot of this stuff, if it can go on for years and years, and if nobody knows about it, well, nobody looks into it, and then it only compounds.
Absolutely. Thankfully, there's a new way of doing investigations that the Department of Labor is doing, in which they're not just taking complaints anymore. They're targeting certain industries. One of them happens to be the hospitality industry, in which it's pretty rampant. Along with home construction and janitorial services. A lot of these different industries, nobody really complains, but it happens all the time, and the workers are just too afraid of losing their jobs to complain about it.
And a lot of them could be in an undocumented fashion. That's a whole other discussion about wage theft, because, you know, people who are here in an undocumented fashion, they're the ones who probably get ripped off the most.
They do. They're definitely targeted. But with the Department of Labor, they do not care what your documentation status is. They actually have a wall down between the Department of Labor and INF, so they do not talk to each other. And they've tried to make that as clear as possible just to encourage anybody that this is happening to, especially the ones which they're not getting paid anything, to come forward so that they can start an investigation and get with them what they earned.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show with Michelle McIntyre. She's the director of the National Consumer League's Special Project on Wage Theft. If you want more information, nclnet.org is their website. You can also get there from our website at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Michelle McIntyre's name. It'll take you right there. You know, in talking about this idea of independent contractors, you know, one of the things that people need to know is, you know, workman's compensation is, in my opinion, if you're not paying it, it's being stolen from you. Unemployment compensation, all of these things that once they label you an independent contractor, they don't have to pay. I think that's part of the whole wage theft scenario.
It definitely is. It comes down into that employee misclassification problem, and it's terrible because you see a lot of people, especially in the construction business, if they fall, if they get injured, and they realize too late that they've been mislabeled and there's no workers' compensation, they can go into bankruptcy just trying to keep themselves healthy.
Or you and I, the taxpayer, are going to have to take care of them when it's the employer's responsibility, and it should be their responsibility.
Absolutely.
And that's part of the problem with this, with how broken our labor laws have become, and how we've allowed these loopholes and allowed these practices to go on. And, you know, if I were in charge, there would be no wage theft. We would have ironclad labor law, but we don't have that will in this country, I don't think.
We don't. We are seeing some steps in the right direction. A lot of the states have decided to take up wage theft laws on their own because not much is going on with the federal government. There is a bill in the Senate as well as the House, but at this point they're just bogged down in committee, and the way things are going, they're never going to leave committee. But a lot of the states have finally stepped up to do something about it, as well as a couple different cities around the country and a couple of counties. So thankfully there's some kind of movement. It's just unfortunately not on the national scale.
What's the most egregious violation that you've heard of? I mean, I'm sure you've done a lot of work with folks here as the director of this special project. Something that might click with people.
There is what happens a lot, especially in immigrant groups. To me, it comes down to it's pretty much enslavement, indentured servitude, if you'd like, in which somebody is being held pretty much that they've told if they leave, they're going to be called and deported if they're not continuing to work, and they're pretty much working for peanuts. Some of the worst ones is they get paid $3 an hour. At $3 an hour, you can't live.
No.
Much less put food on the table, feed your family, and put a roof over their head.
And I would assume that those folks are probably your domestic help, you know, people who
Absolutely.
Are housekeepers and that.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, domestic help, they are not under the Fair Labor Standards Act. There's a large push to get them included, but the way the law is written right now, there is that loophole, and you don't have a minimum wage or any kind of protections for you now.
Jeez. You know, and I talk to people all the time who, you know, they have a labor problem, they have, you know, an employment problem. There's a law, and I'll get a law, and I'll sue, and I always go, good luck, because our labor laws are, in the industrialized world, probably the most pathetic in the world.
They're definitely pretty up there. A lot of the other nations are having some of the same problems with wage theft, but definitely not to the same degree. Canada and England are having issues, but not to this point. Their laws are nowhere close to ours, and they're still having problems.
What happens, you know, let's say you have a company that's a serial thief. They continually do it over and over and over again. I mean, have there been any massive penalties? I mean, have we, as a nation, done anything to these people?
There have been a couple, actually. This repeat offenders, especially, they've seen a lot of class action lawsuits. A lot of workers are banding together, which is something I always highly suggest to workers, because if it's happening to you, most likely it's happening to the person next to you as well. Last week, the Department of Labor was able to get back over $1 million for gas station attendants in New Jersey, just in back wages alone, not to mention any of the punitive damages that they're going to see.
Yeah, but then
and
again...
And then also... Sorry?
Go ahead.
There was also a judgment of $8 million for security guards as well last week.
Wow.
Just in back pay alone.
Well, good for them. I mean, that's fantastic. But at the end of the day, I think you hit on the point. This is an example of where labor unions and collective bargaining pretty much solve those problems.
Yeah. We need to have stronger unions and have more membership in unions, because the collective bargaining, it gives you that kind of community and that kind of support to go to your employer and figure out what's going on to have somebody have your back.
Well, here during this holiday season, we hope no one gets ripped off on the job. But if you do, you might want to go to the National Consumer League's website, nclnet.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Michelle McIntyre's name. She is the director of their special project on wage theft. Michelle, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Not a problem. Thank you.
Alrighty, we're going to take a quick break. Back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Have you been ripped off on the job? Back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
AFSCME, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Tonight we turn back the clock to what we were talking about this time last year. We'll be back live and in the studio on Monday. Enjoy your Thanksgiving holiday.
Exposing GOP hypocrisy, the Rick Smith Show.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, go to the website, download our podcast, or if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app, and you can take the program on the go. So I don't know if you've seen this whole dust up in Kansas. Evidently, this girl, Emma was her name, she tweeted something along the lines of, hey, you know, I just made mean comments at Governor Brownback and told him he sucked in person. So she tweeted it out. And, you know, I guess she got a chuckle out of it and among her 60 Twitter followers. Well, it turns out Governor Brownback, his office complained, called the school, the high school that she went to, and you better apologize. So they pulled the girl into the office, and on Friday the principal said, hey, you got to write this letter. Got to do it. She said, no, not going to do it. So now it turned into a big to-do. She's got thousands of Twitter followers up from the 60 that she had. And this is turning into kind of a political football here. So Governor Brownback, comes out and says, well, you know, my staff, well, overreacted. Just overreacted, and they apologize. He went on to say that freedom of speech is among our most treasured freedoms. And I'm guessing, you know, he's trying to say he knew nothing about it, and it was just, you know, it was just his staff who was, you know, just trying to protect him. The school district, they were contacted by local media who claimed they didn't know anything about it. So they chimed in, they saying whether and to whom any apologies are issued will be left to the individuals involved. The issue has resulted in many teachable moments concerning the use of social media. The district does not intend to take any further action on the matter. Really? You know, you would think, I'm not fond of someone writing something because she didn't say anything to Governor Brownback. I guess part of the teachable moment would be ignore it, for one. Freedom is, you say whatever you want. He's a public figure. It's going to happen. You got to wonder how thin-skinned these folks are, though. It's just fairly remarkable to me. Anyway, last week I was reading this story, caught my attention. Anything having to do with the Real ID Act immediately grabs my attention. So USA Today last week had a story about this guy, Charles Lust, who, you know, West Palm Beach, Florida resident. You know, he was trying to get his driver's license renewed. Turns out that, you know, this whole weird thing, somehow his name isn't what his name is. And, oops, he can't get a driver's license. Turns out when he was 14, they went to court to fight paternity. They changed his birth certificate from his mother's maiden name, which was Lust, to his father's name, which was Bell. So all these years he's been going by the wrong name. But thanks to the Real ID Act and several months of wrangling and not being able to pick up his children at school and not be able to, you know, get into an airport or open a bank account or do any of those other things, you know, after that, problem solved. And understand, the Real ID Act is law. And it is going to go into effect in 2013. Now, there are a lot of states who have said we're going to fight and we're not going to do it. But understand, you're not going to get on a plane. You're not going to enter a federal building without a approved federal ID card. And, you know, it's been about a year or two since I've really talked about this Real ID thing, which just drives me nuts. Where are my T-twits? Where are the libertarians? Where are the crazy people talking about this national ID card? Of course, brought to us by the Republicans. This was one of those thief in the night things where a Republican just tucked it in the middle of the night and it became law. And it was signed by Bush and everything was happy. And now we've got in this country a requirement that we're going to have a national ID. And again, you know, Jim Sensenbrenner, the Republican in Wisconsin, you know, kind of just tucked it in there like a thief in the night. Where's the anger? Now you look at what could happen in all of this. Let's say Pennsylvania, who has resisted to this point, say they decide they're not going to do it. Are you going to fly across the country? And now think about this for a second. If they're making it this difficult to get your driver's license, what happens when you go to vote? Because they're pushing through all of this voter ID based on driver's license. Got to have a photo ID. It's going to be an interesting process as you want to talk about more. And I think the Republicans do this on purpose. I think they set this up on purpose to cause this kind of friction to say, see, government doesn't work. They make these laws. And it was the Republicans who pushed through this Real ID, like I said, like a thief in the night, against virtually every person I've ever met. I've met very few people over the years who think a national ID card is a good idea. Personally, I think it's a horrible idea. But, you know, there are some who say, well, you've got your Social Security card. We're already too far down the path. Just let it keep going. It's the same people who talk about cameras. We want to have cameras everywhere to keep us safe. Let's put RFID chips in the license so we can track them. And then it'll be, hey, you know, like when my daughter was born, let's put an RFID chip in her arm so that, you know, if anyone ever takes her, we can track her down. I mean, you know, I got to be honest, there's part of me likes Ron Paul. Because on these issues, on the issue of liberty and security, I think we're on the same page. I'm not willing to give up my liberty. I'm not willing to give up my freedom. I'm not willing to give up my privacy so that I can have some false sense of security. And I'm not willing to give up the ballot box either. And I look at what's going on around the country. There are a lot of these Tea Party groups. And in Houston, there's one called the King Street Patriots, one of the local T-Twit groups. And they're training on how to, they're actually training. You know, they're holding mock little sessions, and they're making little fake lines, and they're setting up scenarios where they can confront people. And on election day, they're going to go after people in Hispanic areas and in African American areas, and they're going to make sure that the true people vote. And what they're going to do is they're going to hover over, you know, voters. They're going to get in the face of election workers. And they're going to challenge the people in line. I want to see your ID. This is what it's come to. This should scare the hell out of people. I know it scares me. And the idea, again, the whole idea is to disenfranchise people, to keep people away from the process. As where, for me, I'll be honest with you, some T-Twit came up to me in line, we would have a problem. And we would go round and round and round, and you know, we would take it to the end of the road. Most people don't want that kind of conflict. Most people want to go in, they want to vote, and they want to go home. And what they're hoping for, they're hoping that they can intimidate people to stay away from the polls. Because, you know, as Paul Weyrich said, you know, our power goes up as the voting populace goes down. The less people that vote, the stronger their vote becomes. You know, my government teacher said that back when I was in high school. You know, don't bother to vote. Make my vote that much stronger. There'll be less of them. And that's the position that they want to take. Because they know that's the only way they can win. And that's why I'm hoping, as we're seeing people out in the street, we're seeing Wisconsin, over 300,000 people in just 12 days signed a recall petition of Walker, even though there are ads slamming their airwaves. Telling people a million reasons to why not to sign these petitions. Oh, it's going to bankrupt the state. Oh, we can't afford it. Blah, blah. No, get rid of those bums. You want to throw them out? Throw the bums out. That simple. But I look at all this push, this whole push to the voter ID, this whole push to real ID, this whole push to... And I go back to 1984. I guess I was cursed with having read that book in high school. It's all about control. And, you know, this is where I think the right and the left agree on things, where there can be some agreement. I don't want government or corporations having ultimate power. But that seems to be the way we're going. And it seems like corporations are now controlling more of the government and more of the government. You know, they don't want it to go away. They want to make sure that they can use it against us. Scary, scary times. Anyway, when we come back, we're going to talk with Andrew Yale. He's a grad student at the University of Chicago. You know, you look at this NLRB discussion that's going on. I don't even know if it's a discussion. It's more of a shouting match. The Republicans shouting at everybody else that, you know, workers' rights they're not important. I think it is. When we come back, we're going to talk to this grad student who's working, in my opinion, working for the University of Chicago and probably not being compensated all that well. But again, one of those Bush-era labor board decisions, which, you know, you didn't hear the righties complaining about back then, that oppressive labor board stealing people's rights away. A decision back during that time took this kid's right away, and people like him took their right away. Collective bargaining. Going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Just make us be brave, make us play nice, let us be together tonight.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by Ask Me Council 13.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of the Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
Earth, sky.
In November 2012, two scientists at the National Center for Atmospheric Research released an analysis of 16 major climate models.
Their goal was to see which models best match the reality of our existing climate, in order to assess which models' temperature projections might best match our future climate.
The conclusion? Climate models that projected a greater rise in global temperature are likely to prove more accurate than those showing a lesser rise. These scientists, John Fasulo and Kevin Trenberth, published their results in the journal Science.
When asked if these results suggest a profound change in the world our children and grandchildren will live in, Dr. Fasulo told EarthSky he believes they do. He said the results suggest that even the world we live in the coming decades, is likely to differ considerably from the one we grew up in.
Dr. Trenberth, on the other hand, was more cautious in his reply. He said the results tentatively favor future global temperatures on the higher end of the scale.
No global climate model can predict the future. A higher temperature rise in the years ahead would produce greater impacts on society in terms of sea level rise, heat waves, droughts, and other extremes. Will that happen? It's likely many of you hearing this broadcast will live long enough to see and judge for yourself. For more, come to EarthSky.org and search for the words climate model. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Tonight we turn back the clock to what we were talking about this time last year. We'll be back live and in the studio on Monday. Enjoy your Thanksgiving holiday.
Standing tall against the multinational corporate agenda, the Rick Smith Show.
A new liberty. So-
president came through on that campaign pledge to pass the Employee Free Choice Act and get more people the opportunity to enjoy the collective bargaining fruits, to be able to bargain for better wages, hours, and conditions. And now what we see since November 2010, this attack on working people across the country, take those rights away. It's pretty remarkable. And I got an email during the break from Mark in talking about Wisconsin. He said, you're part of this momentum, Rick, and our nation will thank you someday. It is time to rebuild America. And I agree, Mark. I appreciate the email. And of course, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. And you look at this, what's going on with the right and the NLRB. They're using the Boeing case as, their sound horn on, we need to do away with the NLRB. But, they don't seem to mind using it when it works, for their purposes. That's why I've asked Andrew Yale, a grad student at the University of Chicago, where he is a writing instructor there at the University of Chicago. He's also a organizer with the Graduate Students United. Andrew, thanks for taking time for me.
Hi, thanks to be on. I'm glad, really glad to be on.
I look at the situation of grad assistance in private universities across the country that the Bush NLRB said, sorry, but you can't have collective bargaining rights.
That's right. Back in 2004, the Bush NLRB, the appointees that George W. Bush made to that federal agency, stripped us of our collective bargaining rights, both for teaching and research assistants at private universities. Now, of course, at public universities, which are regulated by state law, there have been graduate employee unions for over 40 years, including at UW-Madison, University of Wisconsin at Madison, which, of course, was, ground zero, central location for the attack on public employees and also the fight back, the uprising back in February and March. And as it happens, in the initial stages of that campaign, it was actually the Teaching Assistants Association at the University of Wisconsin-Madison that helped kickstart the occupation of the Madison Capitol and brought a coalition of labor unions and community groups into that whole effort.
Yeah, I would say they did more than kickstart it. We were there for 9 days during the height of the occupation, and the kids from the university were fantastic in organizing. They were the ones who really brought it to the attention of everybody, because they'd actually read the bill that they were putting forth. And as one of them told me, one of the grad assistants told me, he said, look, it's because of our high school education, because we learned labor history in high school, that when the governor said we're going to call in the National Guard, that we go, oh, this is not a good thing.
That was a scary moment. I mean, that recalled the worst moments of police violence and the Pinkerton guards from, the pre-1935 days of the labor movement. And that was a warning. That was a signal by Scott Walker that he was going to come after us. It was a threat. And so the labor movement responded nonviolently. It responded with an occupation, like the Occupy movement that we've seen over the past couple of months in Zuccotti Park and across the country. And the grad unions were a significant part of it. I was there in the first week in the Capitol at Madison. We in Graduate Students United at the University of Chicago organized fellow union members to go up to Madison and support the cause, not only to attend the demonstrations, but to do the phone banking and to do the cleaning up around the Capitol, to do the data entry, to support the petition that they were doing to call on Governor Walker to rescind the attack on collective bargaining. So, that was a really special moment. That was a really exceptional phase for the labor movement, I think, and continues to inspire things like Occupy.
And it truly, embodied. And when I came back from the 9 days we spent there, it truly embodied what democracy looks like. When we were there, they said that an awful lot, but if you looked around, they had areas to feed people. They had areas to take care of sick, to take care of children, for all kinds of things. They made sure that their community was taken care of.
Absolutely. It was self-organized.
But, you know, you look at this, and I think you've just laid out a perfect reason why the folks who want to take your right away and deny you the ability to collectively bargain are pursuing this path. They don't want you activated. They don't want you engaged and motivated. They want you subservient and obedient.
Well, you know, organizing anywhere of the movement at a university, at an auto factory, auto parts factory, you know, home care workers, whether they're in Michigan or New Mexico, organizing by you know, workers across the country, standing in solidarity with each other around things like the attack on public employees in Wisconsin, the attack on public employees in Ohio or Michigan or New Jersey or Massachusetts or here in Illinois. Standing together is what, as a labor movement, we need to do. In particular, in the academic labor movement, among graduate student employees, among faculty, among postdocs, some of whom are affiliated with the American Federation of Teachers, some of whom are with the United Auto Workers, the Union of Electrical Workers, and so forth. So organizing, I think, in higher education is on par. It's, you know, it supports organizing in the country overall.
What do you say to the people who say that, you know, because you guys, you know, you do research work, you work under professors, as I understand. What do you say to the people who say, well, you know, you're a student first, you're not really an employee?
Well, the basis, basically, of our claim to collectively bargain is that in the course of our studies, we work as teaching assistants and research assistants. Now, I think that the terms of the debate have been skewed a little bit, or there's a kind of false dilemma that's set up. Yes, we are students, and yes, we are employees of the university. We provide teaching and research services in exchange for a wage. And that's the basic definition. That's the common law definition of an employee in this country.
Yeah, you're a worker, in my opinion.
That's what?
You're a worker, in my opinion.
Well, thank you.
I don't know that that's really a privileged honor, but, you know, I would think that that would make you a worker in this country.
Well, sure. Yeah, I mean, we think that we would have that. That's the legal basis that, at least in the United States, for having a say in the terms of our employment. What we really want to do is bring workplace democracy to the University of Chicago and to private universities across the country, a right that graduate employees at public universities, many public universities, already have.
Right. You know, I got to be honest with you, Andrew. I find it kind of funny and kind of ironic on a certain level that the University of Chicago, who has brought so much, in my opinion, so much pain and misery to this country, because of their business philosophy, is denying workers a right to organize in line with their philosophy.
Well, you know, the University of Chicago is famous as being the home of Chicago economics, among whom, you know, you one can cite preeminently Milton Friedman, Gary Becker. Milton Friedman, of course, the inspiration for 30-plus years of deregulation, privatization, lowering taxes on the wealthy, the privatization of public schools, charter schools, vouchers, et cetera, and also the inspiration for the kind of austerity measures we see today with threats by both Republicans and Democrats on the right wing of the Democratic Party to cut Social Security and Medicare. And let me tell you, the opportunity to organize at the University of Chicago, the sort of intellectual home of neoliberalism and of the austerity agenda, is so exciting. To build a movement on campus, in solidarity with other campus workers, is one of it's a lot of fun. And the University of Chicago, despite its reputation and its deserved reputation, is also, many people don't know, is also a union campus. The dining hall workers, the housekeepers, the teachers in the K through 12 school, the clerical workers, the nurses are all unionized.
That I did not know. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, we have SEIU Local 73, Teamsters Local 743, National Nurses United at University of Chicago Hospital. We have AST at the lab schools where the Obama daughters went to school before they moved to Washington, D.C. So we are hardly in the vanguard of organizing at the U of C. We are inheriting a history of organizing that we benefit from by standing in solidarity with people who also work on campus.
That's what I like to hear. What can we do to help the Graduate Students United? What can average everyday people do here in Pennsylvania or around the country? What can we do to help?
Well, currently we have a campaign, a national campaign, which we're calling Grad Labor Count. We're hosting a petition at a website we set up called gradlaborcount.org. It is addressed to the National Labor Relations Board. Currently, the NLRB has before it a petition for a union election by the Graduate Employee Union at NYU, New York University. And basically, it has a deadline. I'm sure your listeners have heard about all the Republican-generated controversy that the NLRB has been subject to, and
right.
The fact that the Republican member has even threatened to resign over the new election rules. Well, because Obama had to issue a recess appointment on Craig Becker, they effectively have until December 31st to issue a ruling on the Graduate Employee Union petition from NYU. And this petition could redefine what it means to work at a private university in the United States. Currently, we don't have collective bargaining rights because we're not considered employees, according to the Bush NLRB. The current NLRB has an opportunity to reverse that.
And to write that wrong.
That's right, to rewrite the law and to give us the legal right to collectively bargain so that our employer, University of Chicago administration will be legally required to recognize our union if a majority of graduate employees want it. So what people can do is, one, sign the petition at gradlaborcount.org. They can circulate it within their union among their friends, their coworkers, their church, anyone can sign it. You don't have to be a student or a grad student or student employee, faculty, whatever. It's for everyone. And the more signatures we get on the petition, the stronger case that we can make that the National Labor Relations Board needs to do its job and needs to rule on this petition on graduate student employees.
I'll tell you, during the break, I will sign my name to it, and we will sign up at gradlabercounts.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Andrew Yale's name. It'll take you right to the site. Andrew, I wish you guys the best, and as this proceeds forward, we'd love to have you back.
Well, thank you, Rick. I'd love to come back.
All right. Thanks so much, Andrew. Again, gradlaborcounts.org, the website. Sign up there. Sign the petition. Again, we've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Quick break right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show. Tonight we turn back the clock to what we were talking about this time last year. We'll be back live and in the studio on Monday. Enjoy your Thanksgiving holiday.
Homeowners, cold weather is almost upon us. Use the equity in your house to keep warm and toasty all winter long. Save your energy with new windows and keep the outside out and the inside in. Or roll out a new carpet for those holiday guests. Stop sending money out the door and get it on the house. with a home equity line of credit from PSECU. You can borrow up to 80% of your home's value at just a 3.25 annual percentage rate with a PSECU home equity line of credit. Other rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit psecu.com/HELOC.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Also, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails. Personally, the Borowitz Report is reporting that the Food and Drug Administration announced today that they have declared Texas Governor Rick Perry a vegetable. The decision, effective immediately, means that a serving of Mr. Perry would be approved for school lunches across the nation, the Borowitz Report is reporting. In an official statement, Mr. Perry said he was surprised and honored by the FDA's decision. He said, as a vegetable, I'm honored to join the other three food groups, meat, dairy, and, no, can't do it. Oops. So there you go. Couldn't name the vegetable category. Good for him. So big news today. It appears that Herman Cain has there's another woman out there who just wants to destroy a good man. You know, he wants to do what's best for the country, but these women, they just keep coming out of nowhere and accusing him of things he wouldn't possibly do. Like having sex. Evidently, Ginger White, a businesswoman from the Atlanta area, has accused him of having a 13-year affair. Now, you would think that Herman would remember that. I mean, 13 years, okay. What I find interesting is that his lawyer has come out and said, this is a private matter between, consenting adults. Because, why would we want to talk about, something like that? he's saying, this is between consenting adults. And there's a part of me that agrees. Look, I get it. It's between consenting adults, and it's something that maybe doesn't belong in the... But he is running for president. And, again, it's another one of these situations where, people have put themselves up on a pedestal. And like anything, like they say, make sure while you're stepping on people on your way to the top, make sure you get to know their names for when you come back down. But Lynn Wood, their Cain's attorney, it has been reported, issued a statement saying an accusation of private alleged consensual conduct between adults is not a proper subject of inquiry by the media or the public. He's in no way saying that this is not true. He's saying alleged consensual conduct. In my view, he's saying, that's probably true. And there's part of me that wishes we would get beyond who's sleeping with who, because I really don't care. But when you throw yourself out, like I said, as, hey, look at me. Hey, guess what happens? People look. She said during the interview that, hey, it was fun. My life was ho-hum or humdrum at the time. And, we got to go places. He would leave me, airline tickets, and we would meet in all these different cities. He's saying, it is someone that I know who is an acquaintance that I thought was a friend. But, I don't remember the sex thing. So then I do have a question. Does Herman have a split personality? Maybe this is the answer. Maybe Herman is so deluded that there's two of him. There's the good Herman and then the bad Herman. the Herman that, you know, puts his hands up women's skirts and pushes their head into their into his lap and carries on another 13-year affair. So it'll be interesting to see where this goes. And like I said, you know, it doesn't take a genius to figure this out. Where there's smoke, there's fire. Where there's one, there might as well be 20. And I assume, here again, we will be seeing more of Herman's dalliances. But he's out there. He's on the stump pushing the 999 plan or 999 the movie, which, you know, I just thought was kind of hysterical. And there was part of me that said, you know, I want to cut it up and tear through it. But it's just BS. It's propaganda. It's marketing. And again, you know, this is a guy who comes from the business industry, the business world, who's accustomed to lying to you on a regular basis about their products. Because after all, they can. And, you know, this whole 999 thing, trying to tell you that, oh, we're gonna generate, you know, 400% more economic growth, and we're gonna create 1,000 million more jobs, and it's gonna do this, and it's gonna cure cancer, and it's gonna take us to the moon, and it's not. What it's going to do is it's going to allow profits for corporations to soar. It's going to allow the very wealthy in this country to do wildly better than they're even doing now. And it's going to hurt you. It's going to hurt me. Because the two parts that are not negotiable are the 9% income tax that you and I will pay and the 9% sales tax that you and I will pay on every single penny that we earn. And what it will do, it will wipe out Social Security. It will wipe out Medicare. It'll tear all that out. There'll be no money for that. So our retirement will be completely insecure. Our health care in the future will be completely insecure, which is where they want us to be. But he did admit that, yeah, well, you know, businesses are going to do better. He was on Fox and Friends. Well, of course. And they're not really going to push him on anything, which is why I hope that when we get up to New Hampshire in January for the primary, we get a chance to sit down with Herman. Because I think it would be fascinating to talk to the man, the legend, and the, well, you gotta give him credit. He gets around. So it should be interesting there. Also, you know, want to talk with all the other candidates. And I look at this Gary Johnson, who has come out recently and said, you know, I'm considering running as a third-party candidate, because evidently the Republican Party has left him by the wayside, according to Johnson, whose polling numbers, I guess, have been so low that the pollsters haven't picked him up at all. So nobody knows he's existed. But, you know, he's got an interesting position. He hasn't been in any of the 16 debates. He hasn't been in any of the last 16 debates. So why would you be in the polls? Nobody knows you exist. Nobody knows the guy exists at all. And that's the problem with the media of television. You know, nobody knows who these fringe candidates are. You know, we had Buddy Romer on the program, who I think would be, you know, someone worth putting out there, if for no other reason than to push the discussion toward we need sane trade policies. We need to get people back to work. We need to hold corporations accountable. We need to do a whole lot of things. But he's not out there for a reason. The reason that you've got Snow White and the other seven dwarfs is they're all basically cut from the same fiber. They're all business friendly. They're all billionaire approved. They're all think tank tested. They don't want somebody in there who's going to actually have an original thought. Oh, heaven forbid. They want people who are photocopies of the one standing next to them. And they may disagree on shades of things, but the overall opinion is, hey, free trade's great, corporations are great, don't tax the rich, heck, can't do that. And you and I, we're the ones who get the shafting, which has been going on for quite some time. And, you know, I give Johnson credit. He's pushed, but he ain't getting anywhere. So it'll be interesting to see if he runs as a libertarian. Also, Mitt Romney has, you know, caught some news. The New Hampshire Union Leader had a front page editorial on Sunday where they came out and said, well, we're in favor of Newt Gingrich because he's got a chance of beating Obama, and you know, we want to get Obama out. And they also said that Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney sort of represents the 1%. he sort of represents him. And they had a, you know, they had a, an interesting point. And that point being, and I kind of agree with it, would you rather back someone whom you may disagree with or someone who tells you what you think he thinks you want to hear? Because Romney's all over the map. I mean, Obama's got to be thrilled to death to take on Romney because he has been all over the place on every issue. So, you know, I guess it's just a matter of the day or where the stars are or the moon is or whatever, or where his opinion or his thought process is going to be. So he's got an interesting point there, but I find it amazing that, you know, they point and say, well, he's sort of one of the 1%, him and his $250 million net worth, and then say Gingrich is our guy, who's also in the top 1%. Maybe not in the top 1/100th of a percent, but still up there at the top. Anyway, going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Tonight we turn back the clock to what we were talking about this time last year. We'll be back live and in the studio on Monday. Enjoy your Thanksgiving holiday.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
Occupy Wall Street has taken on a major relief effort called Occupy Sandy in the wake of the superstorm that hit the East Coast October 28th. WIN's Melinda Tuhus visited a low-income high-rise in Far Rockaway in the borough of Queens on a thin strip of land between Jamaica Bay and the Atlantic Ocean.
Sabrina Jackson lives in Ocean Village, a complex with 11 buildings and several hundred residents. Heat and power are slowly returning, though by midweek she still had neither and was told it may be Thanksgiving before she does.
Yeah, Thanksgiving. Are you serious? We're supposed to have family, friends over to your apartment, to your homes, with lights, warmth. That's love. This right here is sad. It's depressing.
Jackson says the Red Cross has been by once or twice with hot food and blankets. FEMA has distributed applications for reimbursement for losses suffered in the storm, and the National Guard knocked on every door to check on residents. But Occupy Sandy has an ongoing presence, coordinating with local residents to distribute emergency supplies. Jackson is the coordinator for her complex. Volunteers move around a large room divided into sections for non-perishable food, clothing, disposable diapers, toiletry items, batteries, and more, filling requests from residents for specific items. Jackson keeps an eye out for residents making too frequent requests for things, which they are likely to sell. Outside St. Jacoby's Lutheran Church in Brooklyn, site coordinator Pablo Benson Silva explains how the operation works.
Our job here is to make sure we match drivers with volunteers and supplies and take it out to different sites that we've opened and the most affected areas. Right now that we're talking about Far Rockaway, Coney Island, Staten Island, Sheepheads Bay.
One of the first volunteers to arrive Monday morning is Dan Lohaus, who lives in Brooklyn and whose day job is working with the underserved. He's on his own time now, though, explaining he got involved about a week ago.
I spent a good week just watching it on TV and then finally got up off the couch and couldn't live with myself anymore. And then ever since I've started, I can't stop now. Now I'm just kind of hooked.
As he moves around the church basement gathering supplies, he says he's headed to Staten Island for the next phase of work.
I'm trying to load up on work gloves, contractor bags, bleach and cleaning supplies, flashlights and batteries. Those seem to be the hot ticket items. I'm also really trying to find crowbars, hammers, stuff to take out the drywall and all the wet stuff.
Melinda Tuhus, Workers Independent News, Brooklyn and Far Rockaway, New York City.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Within their gated communities, the Rick Smith Show.
It was an inside job. Found a well connected. Just in a protest. Don't ever leave me separate. With an inside job, like it always does.
business as usual. And you look at this story that just came out. You look at all of the money that the banking industry made in profit off of the money that our government gave them in the bailout. You want to talk about something to be angry about. That's something to be angry about. And it's something that I said was going to happen from the right when it happened. I said, you never give the people at the top the bailout. You help the people at the bottom. You make folks at the bottom whole. And that will trickle up. That effect will help everyone. But evidently, that wasn't in the cards. Today, back in 1908, 154 men died in a coal mine explosion in Marianna, Pennsylvania. Engineer and general superintendent A.C. Beeson, he told the local newspaper he had been in the mine a few minutes before the blast, and of course he found it in perfect working condition, and everything was in tip-top shape. Kind of makes you wonder. Maybe that's the lineage of the folks over at, well, let's not get into it. But what we hear from the radical right is that the Obama administration is, they're just trying to put coal out of business, and they're trying to put energy producers out of business, and they just want to regulate everybody. That's the frame. I'm sure you've heard it. I've heard it 1,000 times, that you just want to regulate coal out of existence. I find it interesting that, according to data from the Mine Safety and Health Administration, employment in the coal industry is at its highest level since 1996. In 2011, there were more than 90,000 jobs in the coal industry and almost 60,000 Appalachian coal jobs, the most since 1997, according to the same data. Now, again, what you're talking about is, this EPA crackdown is going to cost us jobs. It's actually, industry's booming. They're cracking down on mountaintop removal. And according to the people over at the Charleston Gazette, they report Matt Wilson, the director of programs for the group Appalachian Voices, said his review of Mine Safety Health Administration data shows the number of coal jobs in the region has increased by 10% since the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency began a crackdown on mountaintop removal mining in June of 2009. In other words, the idea of a paramatorium on coal mine permitting that House Republicans are pushing out is completely and demonstrably false. And it's like a lot of what's coming out of the Republicans in the House. It's a bunch of BS. They want you to believe that, if we tax those rich people, you tax the rich people, everything's going to go straight to pot. It's the end of the world as we know it. And you look at the reality. If we had a higher tax rate, we could actually, pay for things, like roads and bridges and stuff. And in fact, according to research by Nobel Prize winning economist Peter Diamond and Emmanuel Saez, they're saying the optimal top income tax rate for that upper echelon, the Mitt Romneys of the world, those people way up there at the top. These two Nobel Prize winning economists and very well-known people are saying that top rate should be 70%. Understand, right now the top rate that the Republicans are crowing about is 35%. And, in fact, Herman Cain wants to drop down to 9. Some people want to do away with it completely. These two economists, these two, this Nobel Prize winning guys, they're saying, hey, 70%. They say that it should be set at a rate where it maximizes revenue. And it could be used to help people at the bottom of the economic scale. Help that low-income worker, pay his bills and do more than just exist. Maybe, just a thought, maybe they could live a little instead of just existing. They also note that even increasing the percentage of federal income tax rate of the top percentile to 43.5%, something that Jan Schakowsky and others in the Progressive Caucus have pushed for, They say it'd be sufficient to raise revenue by 3 percentage points of GDP. And it would still leave enough after-tax income for those wealthy high flyers, more than twice as high as it was in 1970. So they're still going to be better than their peers of the 70s, well, double. But the country will also not have to kick granny off of Social Security or Medicare, and not going to have to kick kids off of food programs, and not going to have to do away with homeless shelters and money that helps people, the homeless, like Rick Scott did down in Florida. Oh, I care about the homeless, but I'm going to cut all the funding to help homeless people. So, you know, interesting numbers there, saying 70%. And if you look at the fact, in 2011, that top 1%, our social high flyers, the Bush tax cut that they're going to get of $66,384 is more than the average of we the 99%. Which we the 99% on average of the 99% will be about $58,000. So they're going to get $66,384 in handbacks from Uncle Sam, and you and I, we're going to work our butts off 40 hours a week, 52 weeks a year for $58,000. And they talk about fairness, and they talk about meritocracy. And I love that meritocracy thing. I really do. And this guy, David Borkin, he's the CEO at this Zimmer Holdings. They make medical devices. You know, they talk about, and he's one of those guys out there saying, and there are a lot of these CEOs who say, well, I get paid for performance. I get paid on a per-share earnings basis. So, you know, a company, you know, how much ever profit they make, they divvy it up between how many shares are outstanding and how much they pay off in shares. That's what the CEO makes. So if you've got 100 shares out there and you made $100 profit, you got a dollar per share profit, so he would get a buck per share, however many you gave him. That's what he would reap. He'd still have the shares, but he would also get that in dividends. Now, what their company has done, they've taken $500 million and they've plowed it into buying back that stock. And in fact, that $500 million, and this is why these CEOs are so dangerous and why they need to be reeled in. The $500 million that they spent on buying back their stock, twice the amount that they spent on research and development, twice the amount that they spent on building their business. Because for them, it's short term, man. It's about how much money can I put into my pocket. What do you think this whole repatriation thing's about? Do you really think that they're going to create jobs with that money? No, they're going to do what they did the last time we let them repatriate all that money that they were storing overseas. They're going to buy back more shares of their stock. Why? So they can lower the number of outstanding stock and make this, oh, well, we get bonuses based on performance. Our price per share went up. Not the fact that we took a whole bunch of those shares back. And thank you, Uncle Sam and Joe Sixpack and Jane Sixpack. Thank you for your sacrifice. We were able to buy back those stock. That's why I just find it amazing that they think we're dumb enough to fall for this. And in some cases, I guess maybe we are. In some cases, you know, I've heard people, well, you know, there's money sitting overseas. And they great jobs with that. You know, there's $2 trillion sitting on Wall Street. You know, these big corporations are sitting on piles of cash. Do you think they're going to bring money from overseas and use that to create jobs when they're not using the money they're already sitting on here? Wake up. It's not going to happen. The idea is the Wall Street bigwigs, they want their guy. And as much as Obama has tried to kowtow to him, he is not enough. Because he still listens to working people. He still listens to labor. He may not do what they want him to do, but he listens. They're in the room, at least. They don't even want working people in the room. And I look at this. The UK has a commission on high pay. And this Deborah Hargreaves, she is the chair of the UK High Pay Commission. They issued their executive pay panel's final report. And in the quote that came out of it that grabbed my attention, she said, it says, when pay for senior executives is set behind closed doors, does not reflect company success, and is fueling massive inequality, it represents a deep malaise at the very top of our society. Now, understand, we're being told constantly, these are the movers and shakers. These are the people who, the captains of industry, these are the industrious ones. All they're figuring out how to do is game the system to reap the benefit. And somehow we think that that's worth emulating. I want people who are out there working and creating jobs and busting their behind like I'm doing and like so many other people are trying. We shouldn't be giving GE huge tax breaks. We shouldn't be giving all these big multinational corporations all this money. And hell no, we should not have them repatriate that money. In fact, what we should do is we should end that loophole that allows them to do that. But we don't hear anybody talking about that. But we keep hearing this, it's a meritocracy. They get paid for performance. Because they game the system. They make the rules that defines what performance is. Our stat of the week. Taxpayers in that upper echelon, the 1%. They love capital gains. You know, you and I, we bust our behind, swinging hammers, driving trucks, whatever it is we do. And you pay taxes based on your labor. That income that you get is taxed as income from your labor. It's not this magical thing that's taxed totally separately. Because your labor taxed up to 35%. Capital gains? Whether I make a dollar or $1 billion or $10 billion or $100 billion, 15%. Somehow when I work, I should be taxed and punished more than when I sit on my behind and collect checks. Somehow malaise, somehow sloth, somehow sitting on my behind and just letting investments in other people's labor pay me to sit home. Somehow that's the way we want to go. But interestingly enough, the stat, they're together, this top 1%, pulling in about half of the nation's total income from the sales of stocks, bonds, and real estates and other assets, according to Forbes. And the richest of the rich, the Forbes 400, those select few, which I really believe we should do trading cards of, their current credit of these capital gains, they currently take about 60% of their income from that wonderful, magical thing known as capital gains. And are they creating jobs with that money? No. They're enriching themselves. And when we come back, we're going to talk about how the Republicans in Arizona are deciding how they have got a jobs plan, and it will knock your socks off. You will line up. You will line up to get a job in Arizona. Stick around on the next break. You're going to love this. Stick around. Jim Beals and Karen Silkwood, the list goes on and on. With every year that passes, 60,000 more gone. Oh, it's a war on the workers. War on the workers.
Proud defender of the working class majority. Rick Smith.
Who's the most? If for no other reason, President Obama's re-election was a victory in the sense that America averted a hard Romney-Ryan lurch rightward, downward, and backward all at once. Ouch, that would have hurt. By campaign's end, it was painfully clear that Romney, a lifelong son of privilege, had no understanding of, empathy with, or appreciation for ordinary workaday Americans. He really is a born CEO who accepts in his heart, mind, and soul the Ayn Randian fiction that America really is made up of a small class of noble producers and a mass of moochers. The man from Bain Capital, who had made a fortune by taking over corporations and coldly axing longtime loyal employees, quietly brought that corporate side of his character back into play on election night. Even as he was on national television delivering his brief concession speech, his campaign apparatus was being swiftly dismantled. Left in the lurch were Romney's many staffers who had toiled so faithfully for so long. Late that night, many of these disappointed and weary ones grabbed cabs home from the campaign's headquarters, only to find upon arrival that the Romney for President credit cards they had been using were suddenly no good. Without even telling these aides, the boss who wanted to be our nation's leader had abruptly yanked this modest benefit from the people who had tried to help him get there. They had just lost their jobs, but multimillionaire Mitt stuck them with paying out-of-pocket for cab fare. This is Jim Hightower saying, come on, with untold millions stashed in offshore bank accounts, couldn't Romney have ponied up a few small bills to cover this last ride home? Of course he could have, but he wouldn't. Of all things to think of doing on election night, cutting off his employees' credit cards was a priority. We're lucky this sorry character lost.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Tonight we turn back the clock to what we were talking about this time last year. We'll be back live and in the studio on Monday. Enjoy your Thanksgiving holiday.
On now, it's back to the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
I got 800 miles of open border right outside my door. There's Minutemen in little pickup trucks who declared their own dang war. Now the government wants to build a barrier like old Berlin, 8 feet tall. But if Uncle Sam sends the illegals home, who's gonna build the wall?
Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Got an email during the break. Thanks for the 11-12 podcast, 2011 report to Congress, Economic Security Commission. For the numbers, $81.8 billion and $13.4 billion coming in and going out, respectively, of high-tech manufactured products from to China. Real good stuff, he writes. As you know, we've been sold out, completely sold out by corporate greed. Most of the import numbers to the U.S. Is due to Silicon Valley's largesse. Those folks running the tech industry owe us big time. Other stats you gave were great, too. You don't hear this anywhere else. Thanks so much. And again, if you missed any of our programs, any of our podcasts, thericksmithshow.com is the best place to get it. And, of course, if you have a smartphone, the Stitcher app. You can take your class war on the go, and we do archive. I think we've got a couple years' worth of our shows still online. So, the Republican job plan. You know, we heard it November 2010, jobs, laser-like focus, going to do it, going to focus, you know, all of our attention on the jobs. What we got, well, you know what we got, the invisible fist in a verb form. So the Republicans in Arizona, State Senator Steve Smith, who no relation that I know of. Smith is a pretty common name. Perhaps we are. Who knows? But he has a plan. He is going to ask people from across the country to donate money, and to this point about $255,000 have been donated to their big project since July. The idea is to put up the first of its kind, the one-of-a-kind fence along the Mexican border, all along Arizona, the entire border. And they're going to do it, you know, entirely with donations. It's not going to cost taxpayers anything. Now, understand the $255,000, kind of just a drop in the bucket, considering he says it's going to be about $34 million just in the supplies needed. You know, the chain link fence or the electric probes or whatever it is, you know, the barbed wire, whatever they're going to use. It's going to cost about $34 million or about $426,000 a mile. So he's, you know, somewhere around a quarter, you know, half, maybe a half a mile, somewhere around there. Now, how is this going to stimulate the economy? Well, it's going to put people back to work. Well, who is it going to put back to work? Not the Mexicans. We want to keep them out, right? So the Mexicans are not going to build the wall. Who's going to build our wall? Prisoners. We're going to hire prison labor at 50 cents an hour. Going to build that entire wall. Because Arizona has said, you know what, if the federal government's not going to do it, we're going to do it ourselves. In fact, you know, they've passed, you know, the crazy immigration bill that they had, plus this fence idea, not happening. Now, understand, in the country right now, we've got about 650 miles worth of fence, about a third of the, you know, the 2,000-plus mile border between the U.S. and Mexico. And nearly half of Arizona has a big fence. And if you look at the fence, you know, it's got... It varies. You've got, you know, just barbed wire in some places. You've got, you know, just, you know, vehicle barriers, whatever. You know, anywhere from, you know, 18 to 30 foot high fences. You've got all kind of stuff. The federal government has spent some $2.5 billion to this point just to build, you know, their portion of the fence. And a government report projects that it's going to cost for just that what we've done. That $2.5 billion to build the 650 miles, it's going to cost us another $6.5 billion over the next 20 years. Well, the people in Arizona have figured this out. We're just going to man it with prisoners. We're going to have inmates do it. I mean, we're a prison nation anyway. We could ship people in from out of 50 cents an hour, have them stand on the wall. Amazing, amazing stuff. These are people who are really thinking outside the box. Now, in the areas that have 18 to 30-foot fences, local retailers have noticed an increase in sales of 19 to 31 foot ladders and also shovels. And I don't know if you saw the tunnels that they've been digging. They can't keep up with them fast enough. So the idea is, yeah, I'm sorry, wall's not going to help. A 30 foot wall, not going to help. You're going to find a 31 foot ladder. What you need to do, you need to make sure that, one, we have immigration policy that's going to encourage people to come in and do it in a legal fashion and have an economy that's growing because of trade policies that keep jobs here, that when they come here, there are jobs for them. I mean, that's the sign of a healthy economy. That's how we grew in the 50s and 60s. We were able to take on more workers. Why? Because we had a growing economy. But there you go. We're going to create jobs in the prison industry. We're going to have more prison guards and people building the fence for 50 cents an hour. And what I find interesting about it is you're going to hire all this prison labor because you've got them all confined. Who's going to watch them all? And how much are we going to pay for that? Some interesting numbers from Agency France Press. Evidently, the U.S. is going to spend more than $6 billion next year in Iraq, even though we're going to have no one there. That's because we're going to have an embassy, and I guess we got to pay our mercenaries. So there's $6.5 billion gone bye-bye. And as you know, some of the stories I've been paying attention to lately, you know, as we're drawing down, as we're deciding to you know bring people back from Afghanistan and get out of Iraq, what's it doing to our economy? What's it doing to these National Guard people? There was an AP report I read today talking about this guy in Michigan. Who, you know, he got ready to go off to, you know, for a 20-month deployment. You know, he got ready to do what he had to do. He, you know, rented out his house. He, you know, closed off all of his stuff, sent his kid off to live with, you know, with her grandmother, all this stuff. Gets to where he's supposed to be. He's, sorry, we don't need you. Now he doesn't have a job. And what I've got to get some clarification on this because according to this article, if you're in the National Guard, you don't have the same protections that someone in the Army has. So you could actually get fired from your job. And I got to be honest, I think that that's just plain wrong. And the other parts that I keep hearing, and we've talked about this in the past, that there are differences in pay and there are differences in, I mean, if you're getting shot at, don't you think that should be kind of the same? But it went through a lot of these soldiers who are, you know, they're planning on a year's work, mostly unemployed people who are planning on, hey, we need to get work and we're glad to be called up because the economy sucks. And what does that say about us as a nation? And what they're saying is we don't have anything for them. I have an idea. You know, if you've called these people up and we have bodies available, there's a lot of work that needs to be done. Don't you think? Now, I'm not saying, you know, build roads and bridges because, you know, they're not skilled at that yet. But, you know, there's a lot of neighborhoods that need grannies need their houses painted, and need things, you know, fixed. There's a lot of opportunity to get people working. So instead of paying them to blow things up, why don't we pay them to fix things up? Seems like a rational thought to me. But, you know, as we move down this path, what we're continuing to see is as we're drawing down, it's screwing with people's lives. And like the one guy said in the article, he said, you know, if you're a 25-year-old infantryman and you're a student at a university or whatever, and you decide not to register for school in July because you know you're going to be mobilized, and then you get a letter saying, sorry, you're no longer needed, that's screwing with your life. And there's part of me that goes, you know, this is one of these moments where you go, we should give people some certainty. Personally, I say we get the hell out and you know, help them get jobs here. In fact, there are tax credits available for soldiers to get jobs. And we should be helping them every chance we can. We shouldn't be screwing around with it. I got to check into this. This claim that, you know, they can lose their job and there's no repercussion. That doesn't make sense to me. If anybody knows, this is a National Guard thing. This isn't you're in the Army or the Air Force or the Marines or any of that. This is, you know, your state National Guard. I got to check into this. Anyway, let's take a quick break when we come back. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. We're right back after this.
Smith Show.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Tonight we turn back the clock to what we were talking about this time last year. We'll be back live and in the studio on Monday. Enjoy your Thanksgiving holiday.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Yeah, the most important issue today, the Herman Cain train seems to have derailed again. He came out and said, here we go again. I didn't do anything wrong. I did nothing wrong. This woman is claiming, Ginger White is claiming, a 13-year affair. He says he knows her maybe through an acquaintance. Maybe they, I don't know, bumped into each other once. But nothing naughty ever happened. Interesting. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you very much. Yeah, this one's a little bit different because it's not an allegation of sexual harassment in the workplace or an accusation of assault, which is exactly what his lawyer is saying, which is why he's saying this is not a subject of a legitimate inquiry to a political candidate. So basically, they're not going to talk about it. But he already has talked about it to Wolf Blitzer because they decided to get ahead of the story.
Yep.
So they did. But Blitzer says, is this an affair? No, it's not. Was there sex? No. No? No.
No.
Well, that's interesting because that's not what Ginger White says. She says that it was an affair.
You know,
she also says she has some late night texts.
Oh, I can't wait. Does she have any video?
I don't know.
Because
that's what you need.
There's part of me in this that goes, you know, I really don't care about this.
I don't care about this. The only reason that this is relevant is, first of all, if he is a serial liar, and second of all, when somebody sets themselves up as the, you know, purer than God candidate, then I think it comes into play. If you don't set yourself up as the pure candidate, I don't think it matters. But if you do, then I think it comes into play.
Yeah, I mean, once you build yourself up, don't be surprised when someone knocks you down.
Right.
And
now, I don't build myself up to be anything.
No, and you know, I'm no better than anybody else. In fact, in many ways, I'm worse than most people.
I'm dreadful.
I'm horrible. But, you know, the thing is you know, you got to give him credit. He's kind of learning the game. He came out before, and he got out ahead of it and said, I didn't do it. I did nothing wrong.
That's his attorney, Lynn Wood, who says the public's right to know and the media's right to report has boundaries.
Yeah.
And most certainly those boundaries end outside of one's bedroom door. Really? Tell that to Bill Clinton.
Yeah, well, you know, he was debating what is. And I thought early on that we were going to have to debate what sex was, because Kane said he didn't have sex with her. So maybe...
Well, we may have to debate what sex is.
Yeah, quite possibly. Let's get on to something that really matters. Because to me, I don't think he really stands a chance. But it's kind of a funny thing. Today, the SEC, federal judge rejected the SEC Citibank deal.
This is fascinating. And what's so interesting about it is the language that Judge Rakoff used, which I think you're going to find fascinating. Pointing to Citigroup as a recidivist repeat offender, which has violated anti-fraud provisions of the nation's security laws many times. Yes, now the SEC reached a $285 million settlement with Citigroup a little while ago, a few weeks ago, over a mortgage bond deal.
Right.
Now, today, the judge said no. He says... I'm going to give you a couple of quotes. He said the first one is that the SEC's longstanding policy, this is dripping with sarcasm, hallowed by history but not by reason, of allowing defendants to enter into consent judgments without admitting or denying the underlying allegations, deprives the court of even the most minimal assurance that the substantial injunctive relief it is being asked to impose has any basis in fact. And in fact, what he said is there's going to be a case for trial July the 16th, 2012. Now, the SEC didn't have a comment. Now, the SEC doesn't really want to go to trial, is what I've heard on Wall Street, because it knows that Citigroup has got very deep pockets right. with its lawyers and can fight it all the way.
Yep.
Now, the case, Citigroup was charged with negligence in selling to customers a $1 billion mortgage securities fund. Well, the SEC said that Citigroup picked the securities to be included in the fund without telling investors, claiming the securities were being chosen by an independent entity. And then Citigroup bet against the investments because it believed they would lose value. So investors lost $700 million in the fund, and the Citigroup gained about $160 million in profits. But the settlement established none of those allegations as fact.
Yeah, I mean, what they got is they agreed to pay a little bit of money back. They agreed to no wrongdoing. They admitted nothing. They did nothing wrong. It's nothing going to go on their record. In fact, I would argue the $285 million settlement was probably a lot less than they took in with fees and profits over the time. So what it sends the message to me is, you know, why can't I commit crimes and make money off of it like they do?
Well, Judge Rakoff refers to it as it's frequently viewed as a cost of doing business. And then he said this. In any case like this that touches on the transparency of financial markets, whose gyrations have so depressed our economy and debilitated our lives, there is an overriding public interest in knowing the truth. In much of the world, propaganda reigns and truth is confined to secretive, fearful whispers. Even in our nation, apologists for suppressing or obscuring the truth may always be found, but the SEC of all agencies has a duty inherent in its statutory mission to see that the truth emerges, and if it fails to do so, this court must not, in the name of deference or convenience, grant judicial enforcement to the agency's contrivances.
Now, I'm right there with him. I, you know, string him up as far as I'm concerned.
You don't very often come across a judge as strong as this.
As class warrior. I kind of like it. I like this guy.
Yeah, this is pretty strong stuff. So there's going to be a case. And I think that there may be one or two banks up and down Wall Street who had a little bit of indigestion around about lunchtime, which is when this story came out.
Yeah, I'm of the mindset that they should be paying for all of the damage they've caused instead of, as we see now, that the banks actually made huge profits off of the TARP money. That, you know, two pages, we can't know what's going on, nobody, no transparency, no oversight, no sunshine. Now we're finding out where that money went.
Well, and then, of course, we found out that they got secret loans, Fed loans made during the financial crisis, and earned billions in profits off them, too.
I mean, it's just, it's nuts. But, you know, here again, this is what happens when you do things in secret. And I understand kind of why they did it, because if they really told anybody how bad they had screwed up and how bad the situation was, we probably would have plunged into a depression.
Right, exactly. Although it's interesting that former Senator Byron Dorgan, Democrat of North Dakota, says about this story about the secret loans, that knowledge of the loans could have led to a push to reinstate the Glass-Steagall Act, which prohibited banks from owning investment companies and vice versa. So, you know, in fact, quite a lot of members of Congress who've heard about this is furious. Representative Barney Frank, who's one of the architects of the Wall Street Reform Act, and former Senator Judd Gregg, the GOP's leading negotiator on TARP, told Bloomberg, who has the scoop on this story, they were unaware of the specifics of such loans, of these secretive loans made by the Federal Reserve of trillions to struggling banks and financial institutions in 2008.
Yeah, and it just shows you how bad the situation was. And it's easy to forget, but once you let them get away with it, they're just going to do it again. I mean, you talk about Barney Frank. The Dodd-Frank bill, in my opinion, is pathetically weak and has so many holes in it you could drive semis through it. Why not just go and do what worked for nearly 70 years? Glass-Steagall worked pretty well.
It's better than not having Dodd-Frank, and it's better than the way they're trying to water down Dodd-Frank.
Yeah, I'm just I guess Barney's going to retire.
Barney is not running again. That's correct. He is not going to run again. He's 71, and he thinks that Congress is pretty much broken. He also has had his district redrawn.
Now, I tend to agree. I think things are broken. I mean, we don't have the ability, to have any. I mean, this whole thing with the deficit commission or the super duper committee. I mean, just exemplified the fact that we are that broken, and we've been talking about it for months now. You knew that was going to be the end result.
Right, exactly. In his press conference that this afternoon, one of Frank's parting shots, and he leveled several, a few of which were at Gingrich. He actually said that Congress was broken.
So the question
and,
is,
you know, he's not necessarily wrong.
No, he's not. The question is, how do you turn that around? Or is it people? Is it us? Is it we the people? Is it our fault that we've continued to gravitate, especially on the right, to the extreme?
There's no answer to that.
That's the question. Lastly, it looks like a new UN report out.
New UN report came out today documenting Syria's gross violations of human rights, which is what it describes. And it's being said that this could actually prompt action by the UN Security Council. Now, I asked Jay Carney about that today, and he didn't seem to indicate that they were moving in that direction. They interviewed more than 200 people, concluded that members of the Syrian military and security forces committed crimes against humanity in the 8-month crackdown on dissent. They document credible evidence that high-ranking officers consistently across the country issued orders to shoot at civilian homes and unarmed protesters, and this is shooting at protesters above the waist and at the head, records evidence of systemic torture and sexual violence against those in custody, including killing hundreds of children, sexually abusing young boys. And we're talking about, I mean, one example that's given in the story in The Guardian that I saw, dissident officer describes a fellow officer as killing a 2-year-old girl and saying that he did it because shooting and killing a 2-year-old girl, saying he did it because he didn't want her to grow up to become a demonstrator.
Jeez, oh man.
So this is quite extraordinary. Quite extraordinary.
So we have this report. What suggestions, what do they think should be done about it?
Well, I mean, I think, well, first of all, I think it's going to be digested, and obviously it will be read by those in the Arab world, and this is going to be taken very seriously. As you know, the Arab League imposed sanctions on Syria in the last few days, and that's a very big step for the Arab League to take, to impose sanctions on a member of the Arab League, even though some of the countries won't enforce them, but many of the countries will. So this is really very serious stuff. Members of the Arab League don't like children being killed like this.
Yeah, I agree, but you know, there's part of me that remembers back during the run-up to the first Gulf War, where that girl came before Congress, testified that she saw as a candy striper, the Iraqi soldiers taking babies out of the incubators and bayoneting them on the ground. When I hear that, I automatically think back to that, and we find out it was all BS.
Right, and I'm sure there are some things that are BS, but we also have, this has been going on over 8 months now. We have, anecdotally, I think that we have enough reports anecdotally, of human rights abuses just from protesters, that we know that there have been human rights abuses because we've seen all the people who've been killed.
Right.
So I don't think we need to doubt that.
Right.
Whether over 200 children have been killed, I don't know, but I've read this fairly closely over the last 8 months, and just reading newspaper report after newspaper report, day after day, I'm frequently seeing the reports that an 8-year-old was killed, a 12-year-old was killed. You know,
in my mind, that's unfathomable. I mean, just trying to put that into my world, it's impossible for me to visualize.
Right.
So again, the question is will they sanction them, and what steps will they take to make sure?
Well, everybody's been sanctioning them. I mean, that's the question. Everybody has been sanctioning them. The Arab League most recently, just over the weekend, for those sanctions, we're waiting for those sanctions to have bite. We sanctioned them. Turkey sanctioned them. Europe sanctioned them. So the logical next step really is the UN Security Council, and that's the question that I asked Jay Carney today, and he did not indicate in his answer to me, and I asked the follow-up, that's where it was going. But I actually believe that it will at some point go to the UN Security Council, because we've now done everything.
Right.
Except the UN Security Council.
So the question is, once we go to the UN Security Council, does that mean us going in there?
No.
Good. That's what I wanted to hear.
I do not believe that.
I'm in favor of giving them whatever they need to take care of the situation, but I don't think we should be in another country.
No, we're not going in there. They're friends with Iran.
Good, good, good. All righty. Well, we'll keep an eye on this, and I appreciate the update.
Thank you.
And Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this.
I'll never bend. I'm with you now.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. Tonight we turn back the clock to what we were talking about this time last year. We'll be back live and in the studio on Monday. Enjoy your Thanksgiving holiday.
He's done it before, he can do it again. This train's coming to town like a hurricane. Herman Cain, get on board, get on board, the hurricane train.
Well, it seems that's, kind of, I guess, what's been going on for 13 years now, according to Ginger White. She was an honorable girl. She honored her. She offered her honor, and I guess he offered her, he honored her offer, and it's been honor and offer for 13 years, according to Ginger White. Again, you gotta love Herman Cain. You gotta love the marketing, the genius that is Herman Cain. It's not racial profiling. It's targeted identification. Because it's not like driving while black, according to him. He's talking about the TSA, the Transportation Security Administration. He's saying we should be allowing them to profile passengers. Because of course, like I said, it's not driving while black. No. It's this targeted identification. He says, if you look at the people who have tried to kill us, it would be easier to figure out exactly what that identification profile looked like. Targeted identification. I go back and I think of Timothy McVeigh, who kind of looks like a neighbor of mine. Very white guy. Yeah. Still a terrorist, but a very white terrorist. So, I mean, you know, while you're looking for this guy with a towel on his head, you got a McVeigh character who, you know, it is our history. Now look, on a certain level, I do agree. I mean, you've got to be kind of rational about who you're looking at. But you can't look the other way for everybody else as well. And not to mention, we have that whole Constitution thing. It's kind of sticky when you're talking about profiling someone or targeting them. You got that whole Constitution thing. Either you believe in it or you don't. That's my problem with it. I'm still hung up on this, what's going on in Wisconsin. They got 300,000 signatures in just 12 days. I mean, it's over 1,000 an hour. And, you know, as the one tweet pointed out, one signature every 3.45 seconds for 12 days. That's pretty remarkable, I think. That they need 540,000 in the next, what, 40, 50 days? I think they're going to get there. But I love the Republicans' response. It's beautiful. It is absolutely beautiful. It says this recall effort is a baseless power grab and that it's false momentum and that they need to continue on Walker's, common sense approach. Nuts. Let's go to the phone lines. Got Andy on line one. How you doing tonight, Andy?
Fine, Rick. How about yourself?
I am great and getting better.
That's good. Yeah, they should know something about power grabs. That's for sure. They're the experts.
Yeah, I mean, but what else would you expect from them? They've got to keep on the happy face. They've got to keep out the propaganda. And I keep thinking about 1984, you know, war is peace. Ignorance is strength. You know, that whole mentality.
Yeah, what's up is down. What's right is wrong. What left is right, you know. It's the opposite world.
Yes.
World propaganda.
We have definitely fallen down the hole. So what's on your mind?
Well, one thing, that Citigroup case and that Judge Rakoff you were talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's been after Wall Street for a long time. I think he's right there in the Southern Bureau, borough of Manhattan. And that profit that Citigroup got in that deal, I think it was a mortgage-backed security deal that they sold, the faulty mortgages, you know, mortgages that didn't nearly have the rating that they were given. Basically, they were selling junk. They made $1 billion on that deal.
Yep.
And only paid a $285 million penalty, so it cost them 28 cents on the dollar to do the deal. So that it's baloney.
Yeah, so is that what they came up with? Because I had asked the question, I wonder how much they actually profited from it. You know, I remember Michael Milken. Remember Michael Milken?
Sure.
The big junk bond king? You know, made hundreds of millions of dollars and end up having to pay, I think it was $100 million in restitution, but ended up getting to keep all the rest. I'm going, I can do 18 months in jail for a couple $100 million.
Right. He came away with that with a lot of money stashed away. I think he gave it to his wife or he had it transferred to his wife so she was able to take care of it. And it was cordoned off from the feds getting to it. Hey, I wanted to mention in Saturday's New York Times, there's a good article by Floyd Norris.
Okay.
In the Saturday Times, there's 4 business golden days for workers, the dross, whatever the dross means. But it shows in here a number of graphs and shows that corporate profits are at a record never seen before. It went over 10% of GDP.
Wow.
It's never been that high in the history of them keeping records. So corporate profits are at a high, and then wages have fallen to a low at 43.7% of GDP. And that's as low as it's been since the Great Depression in 1929.
So mission accomplished.
Right. And also corporate taxes are at a new low.
Well, taxes in general are at the lowest point they've been in 60 years.
Yeah. Personal income. But this is, has to do with the corporate taxes are at a new low. It's just amazing. This is such the best of days for the executive class at the higher echelons of society. And the working people are just getting totally beat up. Totally beat up.
Are you seeing out?
Amazing thing.
I know out your way, you've been part of the Occupy movement out there. Are you seeing that people are getting that? I mean, you know, we do it out here on the program every night. We talk about this stuff. Are you seeing the light bulb going on?
I think California, for the most part, except for some of the Neanderthals that you can never really get through to, for the most part, people get it, you know, except in the outer hinterlands of the state where the real knuckle draggers are. In the more rural areas, but the city areas of LA and San Francisco and the suburban areas seem to get it. It's mostly contest between Democrats and Greens out here and very progressive candidates. So I think in the more intelligent places in California, yeah, they get it, but unfortunately half the state is rural and more agricultural based. So they don't seem to get it. And that's where the Republicans come from. And unfortunately, you have enough Republicans in the legislature, maybe a third of them, that they can block everything.
Yeah, and you've got that that requirement that you have to have two-thirds
of a majority, right? 66, exactly.
And again, you know, that's what the Republicans on the national scale want.
Right, right. And boy, you don't want to have a supermajority determined because they just botch up everything. You know, they always act in a group. They never deviate. Because it's the Grover, and you've said it many times on your show, the most powerful man in America is Grover Norquist.
He's the guy who holds the purse strings.
I can't believe that guy could even walk out of a men's room and feel safe.
I'm sure he's got some fairly high-paid bodyguards.
I would suspect so, boy.
So what do you think of the idea?
The most wanted man.
You know, speaking of somebody in that power elite class, what do you think of Pat Toomey for vice president?
I think he's probably got as good a shot as anybody. He certainly carries the water for the Club for Growth.
Mr. Club
for Growth. He's
the man. Yep.
Right? They put him on that stupid committee, and he's one of the main spokespeople there, and you knew he was going to be the most radical to the right, and he definitely carries the water for the Republican Party. He's the man. I can't believe he got elected. And I got to believe that election was stolen over Sestak.
I
just can't believe that even happened.
People stayed home, man. I mean, it wasn't that the Republicans came out in any wild numbers. It's that, you know, people stayed home.
And like you said, too, like half or 40% of the people voting for were union working class.
You got 51% of the union vote.
That's awful. That's got to turn that around.
Yeah, that's what we're working on, Andy. I appreciate the call, brother. Always great talking to you.
All right, my message was, best of times for corporate America, but are they hiring and helping out the working people? No.
Not at all.
All right.
Just sitting on those profits. Thanks so much,
right.
Andy. Call back anytime.
Great show. Right.
Appreciate it. I mean, like I said earlier, you know, you look at this repatriation, this whole argument towards, hey, let us bring that money back that we've been stashing overseas to avoid paying taxes. Let us bring that back at a much, much, well, virtually nothing. And then we'll maybe create some jobs. And I told you how the gig's going to go, just like it did in the past. What's going to happen is they're going to buy back their shares, increase their profits, and basically stick it to you and me. Anyway, great show tonight. I appreciate everybody on the program. And, of course, you for being here. Thank you to Brett, our chief engineer and chief knob twister, for keeping everything sounding great. Again, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Have a great night. See you tomorrow.